Part 4. Consecration. Disappointed? The note of incredulity in Jag's voice could barely hide his irritation. Jaina is still missing, and you think I might be disappointed that I'm not going to see the ceremony? The voice of Twin Sun 3 fell silent, her attempt at lightening the mood having fallen painfully flat. Jag clicked twice to remind his pilots not to clutter the airwaves, even as he chided himself for being snappy. He was concerned by Jaina's continued absence, but at the same time he had to trust in Jaina's ability to look after herself. Besides which, if anything terrible had happened to her, he was sure Leia would sense it. That Jaina hadn't called for help yet through the Force suggested that she was at least still in control of her situation, whatever that might be. And until such a time as she did get in touch with anyone, he would just have to continue on as though everything were normal, and that meant concentrating on flying. He had taken a mixed flight out to patrol the edges of Solonia's orbit, wary of any unauthorized activity while attention was focused below. Both Prek and Bakarin contingents were quiet. The two big alien assault carriers, Erununka and Firinri, orbiting in quadrants diametrically opposed to the two local defenders, Defender and Sentinel. The latter had two full squadrons of Prek fighter craft stationed at close quarters, plus two squat picket ships. If things were to turn nasty, for whatever reason, they could do a lot of damage while the Bakarins tried to get their balance. While Jag obviously hoped nothing untoward would happen, he had to think tactically. "Don't just outguess your enemy," his father had once said, "but outsee him, too. Always assume that he's two steps ahead of the current play, and be three steps ahead yourself." Jag took his clawcraft and his two wingmates in a wide arc around Solonia. The frigate basked in the light of Bakara's sun, unmolested and apparently completely ignored by the forces surrounding it. He could sense games all around him, moving slowly toward their end plays. It irked him once again to be so far away from the action taking place below on Bakara's surface. But if nothing came of it, and all his second-guessing proved unfounded, he wouldn't be disappointed. A large part of him agreed with Leia that maybe, just maybe, this deal with the Prek would turn out to be the best thing that had ever happened to Bakara. The voice of the comm operator on Solonia suddenly cut across his thoughts. "Launches detected." "I'm on it," he said, quickly swinging his clawcraft in the direction of the numerous vessels his sensors detected emerging from Sentinel's launching bays. His wingmates were close behind him, following him in for a closer look. "Has Bakarin Defense Fleet advised us of the launches?" he asked. The number of ships leaving the cruiser was already up to 20 and still rising. "As far as they're concerned, I don't think they feel they have to," came the reply. "But I'll check with them anyway." Jag was already close enough to pick out the types of craft emerging from the launching bays, but this only confused him. It was a mixed bag, consisting of Y and X-wings from the Bakarin Defense Forces, along with an equal number of Cyruvi, Prek, he reminded himself, swarm-class droid fighters. They flew in elegant formation out of the bays and into orbit, peeling off in threes and fives, still divided more or less equally between both forces. "Apparently it's an honor guard," came back Solonia's operator. "I've notified Captain Maine." "Honor guard?" It was plausible enough, he supposed. The ships were flying tightly together and had obviously rehearsed their maneuvers well beforehand. That showed a degree of cooperation between the two forces, as well as trust. But it still troubled him. The number of ships was approaching 50, far too many for the depleted Twin Suns to tackle on its own, especially if it was caught off guard. Be three steps ahead. "Do you think they'd mind if the Galactic Alliance joined them to show our respects, too?" he asked Solonia. "I'll ask." While he waited on a reply, on another channel he alerted the Twin Suns pilots on standby, telling them to kit up and launch as soon as possible. "We're on our way," Josel said, adding dryly, "I don't think any of us really expected this to be a slow day, did we?" Jag picked a flight of three ships, two of them droid fighters, and tailed them around the planet. The trio didn't react to his presence, but a transmission from Salonia not long after confirmed that they'd been noticed. "They're requesting we stay well clear," came Captain Main over the open channel. "I informed them that we would happily comply, but that we would have to take the necessary steps to ensure our security." Jag smiled tightly to himself. What Main was saying was that, short of Jag provoking an altercation, he had a free hand to do whatever he felt necessary. With this in mind, he continued to shadow the trio of fighters. The total number of ships in the Honor Guard had just reached an even 100, and it was still climbing. "We're under attack." In an instant, Saba was awake and clambering to her feet. Disconcerted, she tried to get her bearings. Then she remembered. She'd been resting in a large chair on the ice barge's opulent observation deck. She'd nodded off and fallen into a peaceful dream of being up on the slopes of the Listian hills. The sky had been red and cloudy, the scent on the breeze relaxing, and she'd lain there among the warm rocks, listening to the restive growlings of her hatchmates nearby. Then Mara's cry through the force had snapped her back to reality, and she realized with some disappointment that the growling she'd heard in the dream was in fact the rasping of the barge's many repulsors over the surface of the ice beneath them. With a grunt, she shook herself free of the dream and made her way over to where the others were standing. The barge was a shallow, oval-shaped vessel that skidded across the surface of glaciers and ice fields with more speed than grace. The three passenger decks bulged out of the top like an afterthought, ringed by the powerful generators and repulsors that kept it in the air. It possessed heavy shields that kept the icy wind at bay, but the howling was still audible as a thin, far-off, Ixl-like wail. There were four weapons emplacements around the curved edge of the barge, and they currently pointed at something flickering in and out of sight through dense snow spray off to the starboard side. "There are two more behind us," Suntirfil said. One thick finger stabbed at a display. 10 swift targets surrounded the barge. Software identified the objects as smaller than a snowspeeder, but just as heavily armed and shielded. They looked like fat coins tipped on their sides, ripping edge first through the air. "Single-person flyers, I imagine, given the speed they're moving." A warning shot on the port side bounced off the barge's shields and into a snowbank. Steam exploded from the point of impact, sending a white cloud high into the air. "Pirates?" Master Skywalker asked.
"Possibly."
Fel rocked the barge in the direction of the snow flyer, forcing it to swerve away. "Shouldn't we try to contact the spaceport to let them know what's happening?" Mara asked.
"Already tried,"
Fel said, shifting the barge suddenly to starboard. A loud thump sounded as the barge's shields connected with one of the flyers.
"But we're being jammed."
"If they're not pirates, could they be enemies of yours?" Stalgis asked.
"Sure. But which ones?" Fel grunted. "Whoever they are, we can't outrun or outshoot them. Our one advantage is the shield, which I'm fairly certain they can't take out. Unless they bring in something bigger, we should be safe in here."
Ciel Antilles put a hand on his shoulder.
"When we reach the spaceport, security will drive them away."
A nearby explosion rocked the ice barge from nose to stern. Fragments of ice ricocheted off the barge's shield and swept into its wake. Another explosion cracked the ice ahead of them, sending spreading fingers across the endless white plain. Fel banked to avoid the instability. When he tried to return to his original course, more fire from the snow flyers forced him back.
"That's if we can make it there," he belatedly responded to Seol's comment.
"They're trying to force us off course," Mara said.
"I think you're right," Fel growled. "If it was just me, I'd take my chances over those crevasses. But—"
He glanced at Ciel, standing behind him with her hand still on his shoulder. He shook his head.
"I'm not prepared to take that risk right now."
"I'm sorry," Luke said. "It's us they want. Don't be too sure.
I'm not popular with some of the syndics, because I want to change their ways. All it would take is for one of them to decide to make a move while I'm distracted—"
Another explosion rocked the barge,
forcing it to turn farther starboard.
"Either way," Mara said, "we're all in this together right now."
"Maybe if I give myself up to them, they'll leave the rest of you alone," Fell said.
"No," Sial responded instantly. "I won't let you do that."
Luke agreed. "It would be a pointless sacrifice. They won't leave any witnesses. You know that. In fact, if anything, they'll use us as scapegoats. What could be more believable than a spat between old enemies, especially if the accused are killed resisting capture?" Fell acquiesced with a nod. "So what do you suggest?" "There's clearly no point running, and we can't beat them with brute force." Luke's gaze wandered around him as he thought for a moment. "I suggest we stop trying altogether."
"I thought you just said we shouldn't give them what they want," Sial said.
"I did."
"So what are you saying?" pressed the woman.
Master Skywalker smiled. "I'm saying we should maybe give them a little more than they're expecting." Leia followed an usher to their seats, accompanied by Han, C-3PO, and her two Nogri bodyguards. The stadium was enormous, practically a giant crater lined with stalls, with the more comfortable booths higher up, affording the more privileged guests a better view of the proceedings that would soon be taking place in the stadium center. The delegation from the Galactic Alliance was, of course, among those privileged guests. They had reserved seating to the right of Prime Minister Kundertal's stand, where he would be surrounded by senior senators atop a large podium that jutted out from the ring of seats. The day was warm. Floating sunshades circulated lazily above the crowd, propelled by the ever-present repulsors. Among the crowd, she made out signs and banners, although she couldn't quite make out exactly what they were saying. She guessed that they'd belong to both protesters and supporters of the Kiramak and its Prek revolutionaries. This was a big day for Bakra, and a lot hung in the balance. Nothing much was happening just yet, though. The Prime Minister had still to appear, and after the early morning meeting, he would no doubt be avoiding the Galactic Alliance when he did. 50 Prek soldiers maintained a perfect ring around the area on which the ceremony was to take place, well away from the nearest seats in the center of the stadium. Han's hand found hers and gave it a tight squeeze. Warmth flooded through her, reminding her of why she loved him. Even in difficult times, when events threatened to overtake everything, he was always there for her. Flashes of irritation hit a depth of emotion that surprised even him sometimes, and of which she was always grateful to be the recipient. "Do you think the rain's going to hold off?" he asked. She followed his gaze. Dense clouds were building on the western horizon, promising a tropical storm.
"If it doesn't," she said, "then I guess we're going to get wet."
"Great. That's really going to add insult to injury." A fanfare sounded as they took their seats, announcing the formal arrival of the Bakoran and Prek leaders. Prime Minister Kundertal, dressed in a magnificent purple robe, and the Kiramak led a large group of human, Kurtzen, and Prek officials in a cleared path from the base of the stadium to the central ring. There, to the stirring sound of the Bakoran anthem, they turned to address the crowd and, symbolically, Bakra itself. "My people," Kundertal began, his voice magnified a thousandfold by speakers floating high above the stadium. "Welcome to you all on this magnificent occasion. With our new allies, the Prek, we join together to usher in a new era of prosperity and peace. As neighbors and friends, we will embrace the universal truths that bind together all cultures. Today, Bakra achieves its destiny, free from fear of old enemies and working with new allies to build a common future." The crowd responded with equal parts cheers and boos as he stepped back to allow the Kiramak to speak. The mutant Syru looked radiant in a shining silver harness trailing multicolored ribbons and tiny bells that jangled delicately with each movement. Its scales glinted in the weakened morning light, making it hard to tell where its outfit stopped and its skin began. Not even the growing cloud cover could dim its unique beauty. The powerful tones that issued from its throat boomed deafeningly across the stadium.
"People of Bakra," came the translation when it had finished its address. "I am proud to be here as the leader of a liberated people. The Prex species, no longer bound to an oppressive regime rooted in cruelty and bloodshed, joins with you in spiritual communion, as our two great nations create a bond that will run much deeper than mere friendship. With the signing of the treaty, we will be one, our fates forever linked." The response from the crowd was as mixed as it had been for Kundertal, but it didn't seem to faze either leader. They bowed to one another, then the Prime Minister and his contingent made their way back through the crowd to their seats. As Leia had guessed, he acknowledged her and Han with only a formal nod. Han muttered something to the effect that he wouldn't trade a bootful of Minok droppings for Kundertal on a good day. Leia shushed him. There was no sign of the Deputy Prime Minister, an absence no one had mentioned, but which she found interesting. There was no time to ponder it, however, as the ceremony was immediately underway. Prek priests, bedecked with streamers, began warbling some monotonous chant as the Kiramak prowled the edges of the cleared space, scattering glinting shards in a perfect circle around the alien contingent. Every few seconds, in counterpoint to the chanting, the Kiramak would raise its head and intone a phrase in its own tongue. This time there was no public interpreter to explain what was being said.
"Can you translate this?" Leia whispered to C-3PO.
"Only in part, mistress. The dialect is not the same in which the Prek converse. It appears to be an ancient ritual tongue, perhaps preserved for—"
"Spare us the details, Goldenrod," Han said in an irritable undertone, "and just get to the point, will you?"
"As you wish, sir. The Kiramak is addressing the life spirit of the galaxy, beseeching it to hear him and grant his wishes. The golden light of this morning is yours, it is saying. The blue-tinted skies and white clouds are yours. Where leaves are green and flowers bloom in many colors, you are there. Where children grow strong in limb and heart, you are there."
"Very poetic," Han muttered. "How much more of this is there?"
"The ceremony is scheduled to last 1 hour, sir."
"That's just great."
Han stretched his legs in front of him and locked his hands behind his head.
"Wake me when it's over, will you, Leia?"
The floating van pulled up outside an unguarded entrance to the stadium. Gaur, at the controls of the aircar following the van, drove past, rounded a corner, and came to a halt. Tahiri was the first to climb out, running back to the corner. Gaur was close behind. Once there, the two of them cautiously peered around, just in time to see Blaine Harris lead Jaina, Melinza Thanis, and two others into the stadium.
"So much for security,"
Tahiri muttered over the sound of chanting coming from speakers within the stadium.
"There's no one at the gates. They just walked right in."
"I suspect it was arranged that way."
The Rin's tail brushed rhythmically against her legs. "And if we're quick enough, we might be able to take advantage of the situation, too." Together they approached the entrance, their pace hurried but wary, aware that at any moment alarms might start to ring out. In the end, they managed to reach the gateway without incident and slip inside undetected. The rumble of the crowd within wrapped around them like a warm and comforting embrace. Whatever was taking place inside the stadium, Tahiri thought, it certainly sounded impressive.
"Can you sense your friend?" Gower asked.
Jaina's mind had been shining like a beacon since well before she'd left Blaine Harris's office, just minutes after Tahiri and Gower had arrived. While she and the Rin had been trying to convince a security guard to let them in to see the Deputy Prime Minister, Tahiri had detected that Jaina was on the move. Retreating from the ministerial offices, Tahiri and Gower had found a droid interface, via which the Rin had been able to determine from security cam images that Harris was moving with Jaina. Although they had no idea of where exactly the Deputy Prime Minister was taking Jaina, they'd set out in pursuit, with Tahiri beginning to despair of being able to reach Harris in time to stop the ceremony. That they had ended up at the stadium where the ceremony itself was taking place was indeed a stroke of luck. Perhaps, she thought, the Deputy Prime Minister had the same idea they had, and was wanting to stop the ceremony before Kundertal's plan, whatever it was, came into effect. But there was an edge to Jaina's thoughts that undermined Tahiri's confidence. something wasn't quite right. If Jaina was Harris's prisoner, then what did that mean? Tahiri was finding it increasingly difficult to tell who was on what side, which made knowing what to do almost impossible. "Well?" Gower asked. Tahiri nodded. "Yeah, I can sense her all right." Then, together, they padded silently down the corridors, following Jaina's presence deep into the bowels of the stadium.
"Where are you taking us?" Jaina demanded.
Harris, a few paces ahead, ignored her. Saul Kelly gave her a shove in the shoulder from behind with the butt of his weapon. It was a simple message. Shut up and keep moving. She did so, following the Deputy Prime Minister down a wide ramp and through a series of archways, barely high enough to accommodate his large frame. A short time later, they stopped before a sealed door that looked big enough to drive a land speeder through. It opened when Blaine Harris keyed a long alphanumeric sequence into the lock. "Move," he ordered curtly, waving her and the surviving numbers of freedom ahead of him. Jaina found herself in an equipment locker, empty except for a single metal container in the center of the room.
"A little bare for my tastes," she said dryly, "but I guess it will do for now."
"As good a place as any to die, you think?" Harris countered. He closed the door and strode over to stand beside Jaina. "Take a look at the box. Tell me what you see." Jaina squatted to take a closer look, carefully maintaining the pretense that her wrists were still securely bound. After a moment's consideration, she shrugged.
"A remote detonator?"
"Very good," said Harris. "Now press the red button." She laughed humorlessly.
"You can't be—"
"Do it," Harris insisted, raising his weapon and pressing it to Melinza's forehead. "Do it, or I shoot the girl." Jaina glanced at Melinza. Her expression was determined, but her eyes couldn't hide her fear. They both knew that Harris's threats weren't idle.
"Okay,"
she said, reaching out with her seemingly bound hands and depressing the button. A numeric timer came to life, counting down from 10 standard minutes. Harris nodded in satisfaction, lowering the blaster to his side. "And now that your fingerprints are on the button, your fate is effectively sealed. Once you're dead and the bomb goes off, there'll be no one to plead in your defense." Jaina focused her energy, forcing herself to remain calm. Soon, she told herself, just a little bit longer.
"You know," she said, standing, "blowing up the stadium isn't going to help relations with the PWEC."
It was as much to stall Harris as it was to fish for information from the man. "If that was my intention," he said, "then yes, I have no doubt that such an action would seriously compromise relations with the PWEC. But it's not. Well, not the entire stadium, anyway. Just the part where my enemies are seated."
"My enemies?" "Prime Minister Kundertal?"
Then, with a terrible realization spreading through her, she said,
"My parents?"
His smile was wide and cruel. "Yes, my dear. What will become evident when the pieces are put together is that you planted the bomb to derail the treaty with the PWEC. The Jedi didn't want Bakura to leave the Galactic Alliance, and they were prepared to stop at nothing to prevent this from happening. Your parents, unfortunately, were simply necessary sacrifices to the cause. Thinking that you were helping her, Melinza Thanis was convinced by you to kidnap me and force her way into the stadium, where a bomb awaited. But just in time, your evil plans were discovered by the misguided but loyal young Melinza, who, at the cost of her own life and the lives of her friends, helped release me. Alas, not in time to prevent the detonation of the bomb. The Prime Minister will be killed, along with much of the Senate."
"And you step in to make sure the ceremony goes ahead as planned, right?"
Jaina finished for him. "In memory of the brave Melinza Thanis, of course," he added, still smiling widely. "It's all rather poetic, don't you think?"
"It's abominable,"
Melinza muttered, unable to hide the tremor from her voice. I think efficient sounds better.
Jaina glanced at the timer while Harris gloated. She had only 7.5 minutes left to deal with both Harris and Sol Kelly, as well as deactivate the bomb. Even for a Jedi, that seemed a tall order. Leia watched with interest as the Pwek priests added a swaying fluid dance to their weird chant. The Kerimak had completed the circle and was addressing the sky above, opening its arms as if to encompass the entire world. "The oceans of space have parted to create this island of bounty," C-3PO continued to translate. "Even in the desert of the void, oases must exist. We invite you to share this one with us in the spirit of galactic unity. One mind, one body, one spirit, one—" "I'm afraid I am unable to translate this particular phrase."
"Remind me again why we had to be here," Han whispered. Leia shushed him again.
"The stars shine kindly upon this world," the Kerimak said, "for it is a blessed place." Leia wasn't so sure about that. Bakar had seen its fair share of trouble, and she doubted some alien blessing was going to change that. If the Yuuzhan Vong kept coming, it was going to take more than hand-waving and the jingling of a few bells to keep them at bay. Mind you, she thought, if the Pwek turned out to be as good at fighting as the Syruk had been, the chances were they'd give the Yuuzhan Vong a run for their money. The Syruk fought well when forced into it. Their fear of dying away from a consecrated world lent any engagements outside the Imperium a hurried, almost frantic air, which was probably why, Leia thought, they were so good at the quick strike. They had honed this tactic over the years until they had become the masters of it, and the more such raids they won, the stronger they became, since the object was as often to take captives for entackment as it was to destroy. Still, she couldn't help feeling a growing edginess as the ceremony built in intensity. The chanting had reached an almost fever pitch, so much so that C-3PO was barely able to keep up with the Kerimak's intonations. The crowd was utterly silent now. Even Han abandoned all pretense of disinterest, leaning forward as though hypnotized by the swaying, singing aliens. "Tighten the bonds. Conjoined in glorious synergy. Although space may separate. As one in the crash of stars." Then suddenly a stab of urgency cut through her. She didn't know where it was coming from at first, until she identified its source as the Force, and from outside her. "Han," she whispered. Then, louder to be heard over the Pwek, "Han, it's Jaina." He instantly snapped upright in his seat. "Where?" he asked, looking vaguely into the crowd in search of his daughter. "Where? Is she okay? I don't see her.
She's not here."
Leia struggled to interpret what she was feeling.
"She's calling to me through the Force. She's in trouble. But her thoughts aren't focused on herself. She's trying to warn us. She's—"
She shook her head, unable to get a proper reading on the message.
"Something's about to happen."
Han turned to his wife. "What is it?" Leia closed her eyes to sort out a mad jumble of wordless impressions, images she couldn't interpret, flooded into her on a tide of growing urgency.
"Han, I think we need to get out of here. Quickly."
Han rose to his feet immediately. He knew better than to question the instincts of both his wife and his daughter. With Cockmane and Meewal gathered close around Leia, he got to his feet and started to lead the way out of the stadium. No one paid them any attention. They were all too busy concentrating on the spectacle taking place down below in the stadium center. They reached the edge of the prestige stand unmolested. No assassins had lunged at them out of the crowd, nor any threats been issued. But there was no denying Leia's nervousness. Whatever Jaina was sending her via the Force, it was getting more urgent with each passing moment. "What's going on, Leia?" Han asked at one point. "Where is she?"
"She's near here. I don't want to distract her, Han. She's—"
A near-perfect image formed in her mind. Explosives, a timer, seconds decreasing rapidly in number.
"Oh, it's coming," she gasped. "We have to get down. Run, everyone, run!
She shouted this last comment to the people around her, but no one seemed to pay her any mind. They were still taken by what was going on below. Her Nogri bodyguards bustled their two human charges and C-3PO toward an exit from the stadium.
No, she shouted. There's not enough time. Get down! Get down!
Her bodyguards pressed her to the ground, Saurian eyes scanning the crowd for any sign of what was to come. The alien chanting was at its peak, screeching over the channel, making it almost impossible to hear anything else. Then another desperate image from Jaina, so clear it formed words in her mind. Tahiri, no. The world turned white and her connection to Jaina instantly went dead. The ice barge slowed to a halt in the lee of a giant snow dune. The grating whine of its repulsors ebbed as it settled onto its wide belly. Fell's hands worked the controls with practiced ease, guiding the craft to a near-perfect landing. When everything was still, the burly human glanced at Luke as though to ask, "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" When Luke nodded his reassurance, Fell killed the shields. The barge instantly shuddered as the howling, icy wind swept over it.
"We'll need survival suits," Seol said.
Fell shook his head. "We won't be out there long enough to need them. This should be over in a minute or two."
Danny glowered at the 10 circular shapes swooping around the landed barge. Her eyes were dark with fatigue.
"Here comes one now," she said,
pointing at a snowflyer, arcing in to land near the barge. "And another," Stalgis said, also pointing. Saba watched as the strange-looking craft came down on one edge. Its engines burned brightly in infrared, outshining the cold sun. 4 spindly supports emerged to support the vertical disk in the snow. When it was stable, a circular panel on its side irised open, and a black-clad female pilot stepped out, her uniform unadorned by rank or other identifying markers. The figure was tall and slender, just like every other Chiss Saba had ever encountered. Saba watched as the woman strode confidently to the curving flank of the barge, then jumped lightly up onto it. A second pilot joined her, holding one of the two-handed rifles Saba had seen in the immersion room. The Chiss called them Cheriks, she had learned. The first pilot removed her helmet, revealing craggy, weathered features under close-cropped hair. The blue skin of her face looked colder than the ice around her.
"Gannet," Fell said darkly. "I should have known." "Who is she?" Luke asked. "She commands a phalanx for a rival syndic, one who doesn't approve of the changes I'm encouraging. And I know she wouldn't approve of you either."
Master Luke dismissed the implied warning with a smile.
"Then maybe it's time we meet her," he said. "See if we can't change her mind about us."
Fell didn't smile back in response. He just slipped his hand into a pair of thin black gloves as he turned to his wife.
"Everything ready?"
Seol nodded and pressed a button on the ice barge's controls. A display to one side of the main instrumental panel began to count down. 2 minutes. 1 minute 59 seconds. 1 minute 58 seconds. The main door lifted up and out, and warm air in the cabin was instantly sucked outside. An icy chill wrapped itself around Saba, who clenched her teeth, bracing herself for the freezing temperatures. As with most Saurian species, the cold would slow her down, so she would have to draw upon the Force to counter this, which she did, igniting a ball of warmth in her chest that spread outward through her limbs. Only her extremities retained any sensation of the cold, and she kept them tucked in close, curling her fingers into fists and tucking her tail near her legs. Soontir Fell exited the barge first, exuding a calm self-assurance. He surveyed the scene before him, then stepped over the threshold to make way for the others. Master Luke went next, followed by Saba, Mara, and Stalgis. Danny and Seol stayed inside. 1 minute 45 seconds. Fell stopped in front of the female pilot, looking her up and down with quiet disapproval. Finally, he shook his head.
"You don't seem the type for open rebellion, Gannet."
"I prefer the term excision, myself," she answered calmly.
"Whatever it takes to justify your actions, is that it?"
Another pilot stepped up behind the craggy woman and waited there with Cherrick at the ready. Two more snowflyers landed nearby.
"I'm not here to banter with you, Fel,"
Gannett said.
"I want your cooperation. And I will get it, too, because we have your daughter."
Saba detected a slight stiffening to Fell's posture, but his expression and tone remained firm and steady.
"Who exactly are we, Gannett?"
"It's not important,"
she said as she raised her weapon and pointed it at his chest.
"All that matters is that we have her, yes?"
"At least tell me why."
Fell stepped forward, his barrel chest defying the nozzle of her weapon.
"I have given the Chiss my all since I joined you. Surely I have the—"
"You joined Thrawn, Fell. That's not the same as joining the Chiss. We have ways and traditions he turned his back on, and by joining him, you proved that you don't respect them either."
"Isn't one of those traditions not to fire upon an enemy until he has fired upon you first?"
Gannett smiled calmly.
"But you aren't my enemy, Fell. Don't mistake me on that. You are merely an inconvenience that I will soon be rid of."
1 minute. "And what about us?" Master Luke asked. Gannett took a step to her right, out of Fell's reach, turning her attention to the others.
"You were invited here on a pretext the CEDF does not credit," she said. "You may have fooled the houses, but your fables don't impress us. Zunana Seacoat is a smokescreen for something more sinister. We just don't know what it is yet."
"Then you intend to dispose of us, too?"
Gannett laughed.
"It was always our intention to dispose of you, Jedi. We never intended to let you leave here."
"Then the deadline," Stalges started, "was a ruse. To give us an opportunity to move against you, of course. So we're all just pawns in Chief Navigator Abe's little power game."
Luke shook his head.
"What did you promise him? Suntir's position, once it was available?"
30 seconds. "He delivered us the means to fix a difficult situation," she said, nodding. "He will be suitably rewarded when the time comes, yes." "The same way you're rewarding Suntir right now?" Mara said. "Don't you people have a conscience?"
"We are aware of the concept," Gannett said, raising the Cherrick. "But it has no place in war. And this is war, Mara Jade. Have no doubts about that whatsoever. In the fight against the Yuuzhan Vong, there can be no gray areas. There are only allies and enemies. The Chiss do not need allies, so I'm afraid that leaves only the other option."
She motioned the other snowflyer pilot to come forward as two more stepped up onto the ice barge.
"Please move away from the door and turn around, all of you."
10 seconds.
"That includes your wife, Fell."
Fell motioned for Seol and Danny to join them, which they quickly did.
"I promise you a clean death, Fell," Gannett said. "There is no dishonor in accepting your fate."
3 seconds.
"For the Chiss."
"Indeed,"
Gannett said, mistaking Fell's battle cry for a qualifying statement.
"For the—"
"Now,"
Luke commanded. Saba, Danny, and Mara sprang immediately into action, along with Suntir Fell, a split second before all the ice barge's cannons simultaneously fired. The intended distraction worked. Gannett and her accomplices were momentarily thrown by the explosions, and a moment was all the Jedi needed. Fell stepped nimbly to his left. Gannett instinctively followed, the Cherrick in her hand ready to fire. With a hiss, Luke's lightsaber flared to life, slicing smoothly up to sever the barrel of Gannett's weapon. Fell snap-kicked her legs from beneath her as Luke turned upon the second pilot, effortlessly knocking him to the ground with a force push.
"You heard me?" Luke called to Fell.
"I didn't know you were Force-sensitive."
"I'm not," Fell responded. "But I can count."
Mara spun around as a bolt of energy flashed by Luke's head, and saw the other two pilots adopt sharpshooter stances on the edge of the barge. She deflected the first shot with her lightsaber, exploding a snow dune 100 meters away into a puff of white. The second shot missed altogether. Saba reached out with a mental hand and wrenched the pilot's rifle away from him. The remaining pilot turned his Cherokee on her and fired. The shot was a good one, and would have connected with Saba's head had she not deflected it back at him with her lightsaber. He fell backward off the barge and into the snow. A screaming sound heralded an attack from above. Blaster bolts scored thick black lines across the top of the barge, barely missing Saba as the snow flyer swept by and swung around for another pass. Two of the other five were already lining up to do the same. "Get those shields back on," Stalgis yelled, picking up a Cherokee and taking a pot shot at the retreating flyer. The shot pinged from the craft's side, but didn't slow it even slightly. "Come on, Saba," Mara said, pointing at two of the landed flyers. "Well, we have the chance." Saba understood instantly what she meant. Even with its shield up, the ice barge would be vulnerable to the remaining six snow flyers. If they were going to reach the spaceport, then they were going to have to take a more offensive role in this fight. Flexing the muscles in her powerful legs, Saba ran for the edge of the barge and threw herself forward into the snow. Not a moment too soon. Her tail caught the edge of the shield as it snapped into life. Flexing it to get rid of the tingling, stinging sensation, she ran up the snow dune for the nearest of the flyers. Mara took the one to their right, using the force to assist her movement through the thick snow. The flyers were larger than they looked in the air, at least twice as tall as Saba, and as thick across as three of her body lengths. Like a glossy black wheel stuck in the snow, it towered over her as she reached its base and hauled herself up the egress ladder. The controls were different from any she'd seen before, but, like the Cherokees, operated on principles she understood. The craft didn't possess a sophisticated security system, and responded to the touch of her cold fingers. Wrapping her tail around her hips, she fired up the engines. The flyer's legs retracted with a faint whir as it lifted smoothly from the ground. Then, with the cockpit vibrating to the tune of the craft's powerful repulsors, it swung up into the sky, forcing Saba back into the seat, grunting in discomfort as her tail was momentarily squashed. The flyer's weapon system was uncluttered and simple to operate. She armed the blaster cannon and targeted one of the six enemy snow flyers coming around to respond to the new threat. Her first shot went wide. She adjusted her trim, rapidly familiarizing herself with the snow flyer's responses. Her second shot was closer to the mark, but she still had to make some adjustments. She fought to ignore the giddying rolls of the horizon as the flyer she was following banked sharply in an attempt to throw off its tail. It had been a long time since her last dogfight around Barab 1, but she was pleased to find that her skills hadn't atrophied. A low growl emerged from her throat as the flyer edged up into her crosshairs. She fired. Sparks flew in a comet tail. Her shot had blown her target's port stabilizer. It wobbled in an ungainly fashion across the sky as the pilot fought to bring it down in a controlled ditch. Saba didn't stick around to see if it made it or not. She was too busy bringing her own flyer around in search of another target. Mara had downed one flyer too, but that did nothing to deter the remaining four. Regrouping in a tight square formation, they abandoned their attack of the ice barge, now firing its own cannon through its shields at the enemy flyers. Saba and Mara were disadvantaged by their inability to communicate with each other, but the force more than compensated for that. Subtle instructions from Mara nudged Saba in new directions, toward new targets. She followed them without question, even when they appeared to conflict with what her own instincts were telling her. When the force told her to take her flyer in a barrel roll right through the heart of the Chiss's diamond-shaped formation, she did just that, breaking them up and scattering them in four different directions. Mara picked one off as she swept by in Saba's wake, reducing the odds to a more comfortable 3-2. "On your tail, Saba." Saba twisted in her seat to see what was behind her, but immediately regretted her impulsive reaction. The sudden movement in the restricted seat made her tail cramp. A shot from behind sizzled horribly close to her starboard cockpit shell. Forcing herself to ignore the discomfort, she jerked the flight stick down hard, then up again, rolling the flyer up and over in a loop that brought her behind the flyer that had been chasing her. It pitched forward in an attempt to lose her, but wasn't quick enough to avoid a volley of blaster fire that sheared off its cannon and scored a hole in its canopy. Wind snatched at the damage, twisting it off course and plunging it into a snowbank in a bright explosion that scattered debris far out from the impact site. Mara performed a spectacular maneuver that knocked another flyer out of the sky and left her on a head-to-head trajectory with the sole remaining flyer. The Chiss pilot didn't deviate from his course in the slightest, however, as the two flyers sped toward one another. Saba felt distinctly uneasy as she watched, knowing that Mara would never back down from such a challenge. Opening herself completely to the force, she closed her eyes and fired three rapid cannon bursts. When she opened her eyes again, the Chiss flyer was spiraling toward the ground with damage to its maneuvering flaps. They performed a quick circuit of the grounded ice barge before landing. Master Skywalker and the others had rounded up Inaganet Naruodo, and the other three pilots and placed them in binders. The four were on their knees on the flank of the barge, watching bitterly as Seol killed the barge's shield and Saba and Mara landed nearby. Saba's tail whipped gratefully behind her as she climbed aboard the barge and rejoined her friends. After the heat of battle, the air felt even colder than before. "Nice flying," Luke said, addressing the compliment to both Mara and Saba. Coming from such an accomplished pilot as the Jedi Master himself, Saba couldn't help but feel pleased. "Thank you," she said, feeling herself flush dark green beneath her scales. "The jammer is in Gannett's flyer," Luke nodded at one of the flyers still parked nearby. "We didn't deactivate it, so they haven't been able to call for help."
"But we could now, right?" Mara asked.
All eyes turned to Fel, who knew best of all how the local security forces would react to the development.
"I think we should make our way to the spaceport, as originally planned," he said after a moment's consideration. "While we're out here, there's still an opportunity to dispose of us and erase the evidence. I think it best we present them with a fait accompli by coming back alive."
He shot a dark glance to Gannett, glowering on her knees before him.
"Showing the Chiss the worst they can do usually brings out the best in them. This is probably just what we need to demonstrate the futility of our inaction while the rest of the galaxy is at war. There's no point pretending we're strong, while our own command structure falls apart around our ears."
Seol came to stand next to her husband.
"I don't want you to go to war," she said, "but I'd rather that than seeing you betrayed by our own people."
Fel put a hand on her shoulder and squeezed gently. He said nothing, but his eyes betrayed the affection he obviously held for her. "We should gather the other pilots from the downed flyers," Luke said. "We can't leave them out here to die in the cold."
"Why not?" Stalgis said, glaring at Gannett. "They seem to have no qualms about killing us."
Gannett glared back at him without apology.
"But we're not them," the Jedi Master pointed out soberly.
"Saba, can you sense any of them out there?" A quick force reading of the wasteland around them located the remaining pilots with ease.
"Four of them are alive. Three of those are injured. This one will guide you to them."
Fel urged the four captives to their feet.
"Inside," he said, "and don't try anything, Gannett, because believe me when I say that I won't display the same compassion that the Jedi have."
The woman turned her red eyes upon him malevolently, but she did as she was told without argument.
"And what about Wynne?" Seol asked. "What do we do about her?"
"Don't worry," Luke said. "If I know Jason, that's already being dealt with." Despair was a feeling Jaina had never succumbed to. Not entirely. But frustration was a completely different story. She had tried twice to distract Saul Kelly, but the Rodian was watching her far too closely. With the blaster trained on Malinza and the others, there was no way she could risk an open attack. Then she felt a touch through the Force that was at the same time familiar and strikingly unfamiliar. Tahiri was nearby and coming closer. Unnerved though she was by the thought of touching minds with the young Jedi, Jaina made her presence as strong in the Force as she could. If Tahiri was homing in on her and arrived in time... Unaware of the subtle life energies flowing around him, Harris had produced Jaina's lightsaber from the folds of his robe and triumphantly activated the shining blade. "There remains only one thing to do to make the story watertight," he said. "If the Jedi really are to be the enemy, our hero needs some realistic wounds, don't you think?" Sulkelly grinned as Harris approached Melinza. The girl backed away in horror. Vyram pushed himself between the Deputy Prime Minister and the girl. Harris, however, wasn't fazed in the slightest. "Either one of you will do," he said, raising the violet blade over his head, ready to strike. "I really don't mind which one gets it first." Jaina couldn't wait any longer. If she was going to act, then she needed to do it now. A swift outward movement of her arms got rid of the binders, and one solid Force push knocked the lightsaber out of Harris's hands. She duck-rolled as Sulkelly brought his blaster to bear on her, his eyes widening in surprise at the abrupt turn of events. She kicked the Rodian's legs from beneath him. Harris wasted no time getting his own blaster out, but Jaina was on her feet in time to deflect his first two shots, directing them harmlessly into the wall. Another two bolts hissed by, exploding loudly somewhere behind her. Then, with three quick steps, she lunged at the Deputy Prime Minister, clubbing him with the hand grip of her lightsaber. He collapsed back against the wall, a look of startled annoyance frozen on his face as he slumped to the floor. Confident that there was no longer any threat from Harris, she turned her attention back to Sulkelly. Melinza, however, had already taken care of him. The girl had him pinned to the ground with one arm twisted up behind his back. Jaina nodded, impressed. "Well done," she said. Then, holding out her lightsaber, she added, "Here, give me your hands." She cut the binders from both Melinza and Vyram with two deft flicks of her blade. "You'll pay for this," Sulkelly snarled from the floor. "Your time will come soon enough, Jedi filth." "Want me to shut him up?" Vyram asked, collecting Harris's blaster. "Not yet," Jaina said, deactivating her lightsaber. "We might yet need his help." Then, with dismay, she saw the ruin of the remote detonator. One of the stray blaster bolts had struck it square in the top casing. The Rodian followed her stare to the smoking, half-melted box and burst into a fit of mocking laughter. Melinza looked, too. "What do we do now?" Jaina thought frantically. "How much longer did we have on the timer?" Vyram shook his head. "I have no idea." "You've lost, Jedi," Sulkelly cackled. "Not yet we haven't," she said, grabbing him under the chin. "Tell me where the bomb is, and tell me now." The Rodian stared at the crackling lightsaber close to his face. "Not that you can do anything to stop it now, anyway. But it's under the premium stalls, tucked safely away behind a ferrocrete support." "But it still doesn't help us," Melinza said, "because we're trapped in here." The sound of pounding erupted from the far side of the locked door. Jaina reached out through the Force and felt Tahiri trying to attract her attention, but the door was too thick to shout through, and two Jedi weren't enough to form a Force meld. Frustration returned, but only for an instant. Looking over to Sulkelly, she suddenly remembered. She hurried across the room to where the Rodian lay pinned by Melinza. A quick search of his pockets, and she soon found what she was looking for. Her comlink. "Tahiri, can you hear me?" A second's pause before, "Jaina, we're right here outside the door." "I know. Can you get it open, though?" There was some hesitation. "The code sequence might take a minute or two to get through, but yes, we should be able to get you out." "We don't have a minute or two, Tahiri. Listen, there's a bomb. You have to get to it and defuse it." "Where is it?" Jaina repeated the information that Sulkelly had given her. "How long do we have? I'm not sure, but I'm guessing not much. There was a 10-minute timer, and it's already been ticking away for some time." "You'd better get going, while I find out how to disarm it." "Okay. Gower's going to stay here and try to get the door open."
He's the Rin who's been helping us. You can trust him.
Jaina nodded.
Don't worry about us. We're probably safer in here than you are. Just get going.
She sensed Tahiri hurrying away up the corridor, calling on the Force to maximize her speed. She could feel the girl's exhaustion, too, and wished she could send some of her strength to help. But there was little she could do in that regard. She had to direct her efforts elsewhere. Jaina turned away from the door and squatted down next to the squirming Salkelli, still futilely trying to break free.
"I thought Rodians always had an escape plan," she said.
The Rodian spat at her and glared. She didn't let it bother her.
"How do I disarm the bomb, Salkelli?"
"How should I know?" he growled. "And what makes you think I'd tell you even if I did? I've already told you too much."
Jaina sighed. "I'll try again," she said,
this time with some forced persuasion behind it.
"How do I disarm the bomb?"
His eyes glazed over slightly as he said, "It can't be deactivated now." That threw her for a moment.
"There has to be a way."
She pushed even harder with the Force. She didn't believe for a moment that the Rodian wouldn't have had at least some knowledge of Harris's bomb.
"Now tell me what it is, Salkelli. How is the bomb disarmed?"
"The remote detonator," he answered without resistance. Then, glancing over to the ruined box, he smiled nastily. "But like I said, there's no way to disarm it now." Jaina cursed under her breath. It was unlikely the Rodian had the will to resist the Force persuasion, so he was probably telling the truth, or the truth as he saw it, anyway. And even if the Deputy Prime Minister did know of another way to deactivate the bomb, it was unlikely they'd be able to rouse him in time to get that information.
"I'm almost there,"
Tahiri said over the comlink, her voice crackling through dozens of meters of durasteel and ferrocrete.
"Do you have the information?"
Jaina shook her head, beginning to feel nauseous.
"Tahiri, I don't think it can be disarmed."
"What?"
"Harris rigged it so that it can't be switched off without the remote detonator, and that's been destroyed." "There has to be a way, Jaina."
"There isn't. I've seen devices like these before. We're lucky it didn't automatically go off early."
"Then what are we going to do?"
"We try to warn Mom and Dad, and get them to alert Kundertal. If we're quick enough, they might be able to clear the stand and get everyone away before—"
"How much time do we have?"
"I still don't know, Tahiri. But not much, so get out of there as quickly as possible, okay?" She tried to raise her mother on the comlink, but its signal was too weak. Instead, she reached out through the Force. Leia Organa Solo was one mind among thousands, but her mental signature was instantly recognizable. Jaina felt secondhand the hypnotic power of the consecration ceremony gathering force throughout the stadium, and fought to punch through it.
"Mom, you have to get out of there. There's a bomb."
It was difficult to convey more than sense impressions through the Force, but she tried her best, and did receive a faint hint of a response for her efforts. She couldn't tell, though, if her mother understood.
"I found it," Tahiri said. "I have the bomb right here in front of me."
Jaina's anxiety doubled.
"What are you still doing in there, Tahiri? I told you to get out." "I'm going to try to disarm it." "Tahiri, do as I tell you. Just get out of there and try to warn the others. Jaina, we don't know how much time we have. What if they can't clear everyone out in time?"
Jaina bit back an angry response.
"You don't know what you're doing, though."
"Then I'll just have to improvise, won't I?" came the reply. Jaina reached out with all her strength and tried to force meld with Tahiri. The link was faint, but she did receive a brief clear view through Tahiri's eyes. The bomb in front of her was not equipped for manual disarming, but it did have a timer. In bold blue digits, Jaina could see they had 70 seconds left. 69. Then something cold and dark pushed her away, and the link ebbed.
"Mom, can you hear me?"
Jaina called, fighting a mounting desperation.
"Get everyone out of there, fast!"
The locker door hissed open, and the Rin called Gower rushed in, his tail straight up behind him. "What's going on?" Jaina checked her chronometer. They had only 30 seconds left.
"Get that door shut," she told him sharply. "That bomb's about to go off."
The meld with Tahiri returned faintly.
"I'm making progress," the girl said over the comlink. "I've got the cover off, and I think I can—"
Sparks flashed, and Jaina received the sharp tang of burning wires through the force. At the same time, she felt the equally sharp stab of hopelessness as Tahiri realized she didn't have a clue what to do next.
"Tahiri, you've got to get out of there."
"No, there has to be a way."
"There isn't. Now move."
"I can do it, Jaina. I have to."
"Why? So you can die like Anakin?"
The backlash of pain surprised Jaina and made her instantly regret her words.
"Tahiri, you don't trust me, do you, Jaina?"
"You don't have to prove anything to me, Tahiri. Please, just, I can do it. I know I can."
"Can we argue about this later, Tahiri?"
But again, something dark and powerful broke the meld between them, its presence casting a black shape in Jaina's mind.
"Mon Malrish hu Kamasami."
The words cut into Jaina like a jagged blade.
"Tahiri, no!"
Tahiri cried, her desperation shattering the fragile darkness.
"Leave me alone!"
Her will was not as strong as the darkness, though, and the broken pieces of the shadow reassembled, twice as powerful as it had been before.
"Doroak Vong Prat."
The voice over the comlink didn't sound like Tahiri's, but Jaina recognized the words. She'd heard it on the lips of her enemies many times in the past. It was a Yuuzhan Vong battle cry.
"Rina?"
Jaina asked. The voice changed to basic with uncanny ease.
"Anakin killed me, and now you want me dead too. I won't let that happen. Krell Nag Shn Rushfek." "Wait, Rina."
It was too late. Time had run out. The bomb went off with a muffled concussion that Jaina felt rather than heard. The floor bucked beneath her, throwing everyone to the ground. The lights went out. Someone screamed. Jaina collected herself when the shaking died down. She frantically reached out into the darkness for Tahiri's mind. No matter how much she tried, though, she couldn't find it anywhere. Tahiri was gone. Wynn's fear was strong in Jason's mind as he tracked her and her Chiss escort along the ice tunnels far below Scylla's frozen surface. He sensed that she was frightened, but had nothing concrete on which to pin her concerns. Although she clearly didn't like Chief Navigator Abe, as yet he'd done nothing overt to threaten her. "Let's just hope it stays that way," he thought.
"I don't understand," Irolia hissed from behind him. "Why would Abe kidnap Assistant Syndic Fell's daughter?"
"I have no idea, Commander. All I do know is that he has taken her, and that we have to stop him before any harm comes to her."
"But how can you know this?" she asked.
"This force of yours is something we don't have. How do I know you're telling me the truth? For all I—" He motioned her to silence. They had reached an intersection, and his breath puffed into thick, frosty clouds as he peered around the corner. He didn't have time to justify his actions to Irolia, or try to convince her of the existence of the Force. Wynn was close. He could feel her. The way ahead held a faint glimmer of light, the bubble of warmth and heat containing Abe, the two guards, and Suntir Fell's youngest daughter was moving rapidly away from them.
"They're heading for the Iceway Terminus," Irolia said, looking past him,
"which is an underground transport station. There are excavated tunnels through the bedrock, far below the ice. Carriages travel through them." Jason quickly considered their options.
"Then we'll just have to stop them before they reach it."
"Agreed. Because if they manage to get onto a carriage, then they could be on the other side of the planet within an hour." He turned to look at her. The Chiss commander was staring ahead with a determined expression, her blue skin and red eyes contrasting powerfully in the icy gloom. All suggestion of the skepticism she'd voiced just moments earlier appeared to have left her. Even if she wasn't convinced about his motives, at least she was determined to help him get Wynn back in one piece. He felt vaguely sorry for her. She'd been put in charge of babysitting the visitors from the Galactic Alliance through Chiss Space and on Scylla. It wasn't her fault that she'd been betrayed by a senior officer, whose orders she hadn't even thought to question. He could understand her wanting to fix the situation before word of her mistakes spread. The light flickered and died at the end of the tunnel. At some point, he knew, he was going to have to try to get closer. He could think of no actual way to hide along the dark and icy corridor so that Abe and the other guards wouldn't see them, but he couldn't afford to hold back, either. The longer he left it, the farther away Wynn became. "Come on, Commander. We're going to have to run to catch them."
"Are you sure you'll be able to? Running in these temperatures can be more draining than people realize."
"You just worry about keeping up."
He let the force flow through him, guiding his footfalls and strengthening the muscles in his legs. His fatigue washed away, along with his concerns for Wynn and the others. He concentrated solely on running, a single, pure action that allowed him to focus his thoughts. What he would do when he caught up with Abe, he didn't rightly know, nor did it matter. Nothing did. He existed simply to cross this short stretch of ice that separated Wynn from himself. And while he remained focused on that solitary task, he was able to do it with an athletic ease. Irelia matched his pace beside him, but with considerably more effort. By the time they reached the junction where the lit section had disappeared, her breathing was coming in long, deep gulps. She leaned against the nearest wall as Jason peered around another corner. They seemed to be a lot closer now. So close, in fact, the day was clearly distinguishable within the bubble of light ahead by virtue of the gleam off his scalp.
"Are you okay to continue?" he whispered to Irelia.
She nodded.
"I am in perfect physical condition," she said, wiping sweat from her forehead. "I could run the same distance three times over and still fight at the end of it."
"That's good to hear," Jason said, "because that's probably what you're going to have to do." He glanced around the icy corner again. "How far do you figure before they reach those carriages?"
"There are only two more junctions between here and the Iceway terminus."
"Then I guess we'd better get moving. Are you sure you're ready?"
"You just worry about keeping up," she said.
He smiled at the commander's quip, then continued with his pursuit. He was more cautious this time, because they were well within sight of Abe's party. He didn't know how well sound carried through the fields, keeping the heat in, but he couldn't afford to assume that their approach would be covered. He didn't even know if he'd be able to penetrate the field walls around the bubble. Another two corners would give him and Irelia time to catch up as Abe and Wynn reached the terminus, when they would be distracted and out of the fields. As Jason drew closer, a faint hissing broke the silence. The sound came from the field walls as they swept over the icy surfaces around the bubble. Beneath the sound was a hint of voices, too low for him to catch anything more than broken fragments. From the handful of words he was able to make out, though, he knew that Wynn was starting to question Abe's intentions, asking why her father was having her transported via the iceways rather than the barge. Abe muttered something that went unheard, as did Wynn's response, although there was no mistaking the misgivings in the girl's tone. They rounded one corner, then the second. All that lay between them and the iceway terminus now was a straight stretch of tunnel. Jason and Irelia kept pace with the bubble, lurking just beyond the wash of light it cast. Jason unclipped his lightsaber from his belt and held it ready, his thumb resting on the activation stud. The bubble dissolved as Abe, the guards, and Wynn left the tunnel. Beyond them was the terminus, a much smaller space than Jason had imagined. Long and narrow, it had a series of sliding panels set into the far wall, which Jason presumed to be airlocks leading to the carriages. Jason and Irelia stopped at the end of the tunnel, watching quietly as Abe and the others crossed the narrow room to one of the sliding doors. Only when one of these doors grated open did Wynn give in to the misgivings Jason had heard in her voice.
"I'd like to talk to my father," she said, pulling away from the ex-Imperial and his Chiss sidekicks. "I want to know where he's sending me."
"It's a little late to ask that, don't you think?" Abe's skull gleamed. His mouth, overshadowed by his large nose, curled into a menacing snarl.
She shook her head uneasily. "This isn't right," she said, taking another step back. "You're lying to me. My father wouldn't ask me to be taken down here."
Abe rounded on her in order to cut off her route to the exit.
"And what possible reason would I have to lie to you, child? I am your father's trusted servant. You know that. Why do you dishonor me with such accusations?"
"Trusted servant?" she shot back, looking frightened but determined.
"My father says he never even heard of you until you turned up on the Chiss border looking for asylum. He thinks you're a deserter."
Jason could no longer see Abe's face, but his posture noticeably stiffened.
"Your accusations grow with your hysteria, child," he said frostily. "You should be mindful of the things you say." "Do you deny it?" she continued, regardless of the obvious danger she was in. "It is irrelevant," he replied, unclipping the holster at his waist. "You're coming with me, whether you like it or not, and I'll hear no more said about your father. His time is over. The CEDF has better things to do than pander to neighbors who can't mind their own affairs. The sooner he and you are out of the way, the better it will be for all concerned."
Wynne backed away a few more steps, straight into the arms of one of the guards. Abe drew his blaster and approached her. Jason had heard enough. Before, it might have just been possible that Abe was following orders, but now there was no mistaking his intentions.
"I really think it's in your best interest to lower that weapon and let the girl go, Chief Navigator," Jason said, activating his lightsaber as he stepped out from the shadowed corridor. Abe spun around, redirecting his blaster's aim at Jason. Then, seeing Aerolia with him, his face crumpled into a frown. "What is the meaning of this? I demand an explanation."
"Funny, but I was about to say exactly the same thing," the commander said, drawing her own blaster.
"I need explain nothing to you, Commander," Abe sneered. "I'm your superior officer, remember? And I am ordering you to turn around and return to your normal duties. As an officer of the Expansionary Defense Force, I believe it is my duty to ensure the safety and security of the Chiss Realm. That directive, as you are well aware, supersedes all others. It is my firm belief that I am following that directive right now."
Aerolia raised her blaster and sighted Abe along the barrel.
"So if you wouldn't mind dropping your weapon, sir..."
"You fool!" Jason felt the force rush through him an instant before Abe fired. His instincts moved him forward, swinging his lightsaber up and across to intersect the bolt before it could hit Aerolia. A split second later, she too fired. Jason didn't hesitate. His lightsaber came down again, deflecting that bolt also.
"What are you doing?" Aerolia snapped.
Jason didn't have time to explain to the commander that it was unnecessary for anyone to die. He was too busy advancing on Abe as the chief navigator slowly retreated. The guards stood behind him, frozen with indecision.
"You cowards!" Abe yelled back at them.
"He's only a boy. Take him!" But the guards took another step away from him, making it clear to Jason and Aerolia that Abe was on his own in this. When the commander indicated for them to lower their weapons, they did so without hesitation, laying them on the floor at their feet. Whether they had been part of the conspiracy or simply following orders was something that would have to be determined later. Realizing his situation, Abe grabbed Wynne and shoved her forcibly between himself and Jason. Then he turned to run for the open iceway carriage door, his only chance at obtaining freedom. Jason took three long strides to bring himself within reach of the fleeing man, his lightsaber raised, tensed and ready to strike. A single exertion of will, backed up by the force, wrenched the carriage doors closed. Abe crashed into them at full tilt, toppling back onto the ice at Jason's feet, his blaster flying out of his stunned grasp and clattering across the floor. Wynne was quick to pick it up and pointed at him.
"There's nowhere to run," Jason said, the steady thrum of his lightsaber sounding in the cold air.
He felt Wynne watching in amazement as he stood over Abe, willing the man to give up. Defiance lingered in Abe's eyes, but then suddenly flickered and died. The man sagged back to the floor with a defeated sigh. Jason stepped back, lowering his lightsaber, glad that the crisis was over and that nobody had been hurt. He activated his comlink, and it bleeped immediately. It was his uncle. "Jason, is everything all right?" "It is now," he answered. "And Wynn, she's fine. I'll fill you in on all the details later." "Well done, Jason. You've defused a potentially difficult situation." "Thanks, Uncle Luke," he returned, deactivating his lightsaber and reattaching it to his belt. Irelia was already busy speaking into a wall communicator calling for backup. "How's everything there?" "Under control. We've heard from Tekley. Someone made a half-hearted attempt to break through Jade Shadow's airlock, but they failed and haven't come back. Port security is already looking into the incident. It looks like we've weathered the storm rather well, don't you think?" As Jason watched the guards hoist Abe onto his feet, he found he could only nod in silent agreement. A failed attempt to put them out of the picture would almost certainly bring the Chiss more firmly behind them, as well as Fel. The real leaders behind the attempt, assuming Abe wasn't as high up as they went, would no doubt lie low for a while, fearing reprisals from either Chiss loyal to the existing command structure like Irelia, or the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances, which was bound to take an attack on peaceful diplomats poorly. It might also mean that the 2-day deadline would be extended. "How long do you think before you'll get back?" he asked his uncle. "Probably within the hour," Luke said. "We'll resume our search then." Jason nodded to himself again, glad to be able to put the incident behind them and get back to work. "And Jason?" Luke said. "Don't assume that everything that happened here has been unimportant. The smallest action can have the largest consequences. The good work we've done today may have far-reaching consequences, consequences we can only guess at right now." "I know, Uncle Luke," Jason said. "I'll see you when you get back, okay?" "You take care, Jason. You too." He closed the line and returned the comlink to his belt, reflecting upon the simple truth of his uncle's words. He couldn't help but wonder at what the consequences of this day would be. Perhaps saving Wynn would enable her to achieve her ambition of seeing Coruscant. One day, when the war was over, the girl could easily follow in her brother's footsteps and leave Chiss space in favor of the Galactic Alliance. He sensed strength and determination in her, as well as a keen intellect. If she wanted to do something badly enough, he had no doubt that she would find a way. "What will become of you, Winfell?" he wondered to himself. Only time would tell, he supposed, and if he could give her nothing else, he would do his best to give her that, at least. The time to realize her potential, her and the Chiss, as well as the galaxy itself. He shrugged off the train of thought, forcing himself back to the present. Wynn was standing to one side, the blaster in her hand trembling slightly. She was staring at him with something approximating awe. "Are you all right?" he asked her. She nodded once. "A little shaken, but I'll be okay." She couldn't seem to take her eyes off him. "Thank you for coming when you did. You were amazing." He felt himself flush slightly, at the compliment as well as the girl's obvious admiration for him that had prompted it. But he forced himself to ignore it. There were much more important things to concern himself with. Bigger than Wynn or Abe. Bigger even than himself. The search for Zonana Seacoat was of paramount importance. Everything else was just a distraction. "All in a day's work," he told Wynn, with a smile that he hoped would hide his discomfort at her adoration. "The life of a Jedi is not a boring one." "Mom! Mom!" In the aftermath of the explosion, Jaina's mind was filled with psychic pain. She sent her mind out among the wounded and dying, searching for her mother. She found her mother and father down in the thick of it, fighting their way through the panicked crowd, trying to get to where help was needed the most. Jaina sat up in the gloom of the room's emergency lighting. The locker was filled with dust, but it had remained intact, just as Harris had anticipated it would. Melinza was climbing to her feet, shaking her head groggily. Viram and Gower were clambering upright too, both coughing violently,
as the dust caught in their throats. Saul Kelly lay curled in a ball, looking up with a grin on his face, triumphant that their best efforts to stop the bomb had failed. Harris remained where Jaina had left him, out cold in the corner. She collected the comlink from the floor where she'd dropped it and quickly activated it.
"Mom?"
She opened the locker door to reduce the interference.
"Mom, can you hear me?"
It took a few moments before Leia answered.
"I hear you, Jaina."
Relief rushed through her at the sound of her mother's voice.
"Are you all right?" "I'm okay, but Mom, Tahiri..." "I know. I felt it too. Do you think she's okay?" "I don't know, Jaina. I'll never forgive myself if she's..."
Leia didn't let her finish.
"You aren't to blame for anything that has happened here, Jaina."
Jaina knew that wasn't true. If she hadn't been so closed off to the girl in the first place, if she'd tried to help her confront her problems earlier instead of... She broke away from the guilt-ridden thought.
"How bad is it up there, Mom?"
"It's utter chaos. The blast took out the Prime Minister's stalls. Security is trying to clear the area now."
Jaina caught flashes from her mother. Frightened faces, tangled wreckage, and blood. Lots of blood. Before she could ask if there was anything she could do, Saul Kelly took the opportunity to gloat.
"You look a little concerned there, Jedi," the Rodian said with a half-smile, half-sneer.
"Not so sure of yourself now, are—"
Viram didn't ask this time. He just shut the Rodian up by stunning him with the butt of his blaster.
"What do we do now?" he asked, stepping up to Jaina.
"We go topside to help," she answered. "Besides, security has to know about these two."
"I'll go," Melinza said.
Jaina shook her head.
"They might not believe you."
"No," the girl said, "but they will listen."
"And I can stay here and keep an eye on these two, if you like," Viram said. Jaina thought about this for a moment, then nodded.
"Okay. I'll back you up when I get there."
"Wait a minute," Gower said. "Where are you going?"
"To find Tahiri."
"Then I'm coming too," he said.
The Rin had a look in his eye that Jaina recognized from her father, the kind that said there was no point arguing. Jaina shrugged helplessly and let him follow her out as they retraced Tahiri's steps through the damaged corridors, updating Leia as they went. The stadium's structure had held, but it was going to require an extensive overhaul. The closer they got to the center of the blast, the more damage there was. Ceilings had come down. Ferrocrete had cracked. Stanchions were twisted, and the air was full of dust.
"Through here, I think," she said,
following the vague impressions she'd received from Tahiri's mind. Everything had looked so different then, with the smooth, clean corridors. Now they were in ruins, open to the sky. The cries of the wounded were very real from such close quarters, and the smell of smoke and dust was powerfully strong. At the heart of the destruction, they found a clear space about 2 meters across. The blast had destroyed everything around the area, but nothing within it. And there, at its center, lay Tahiri, curled up like a child, hiding from a nightmare. Jaina came to a halt at the edge of the unaffected area, her heart pounding sickeningly fast in her chest. She tried reaching for the girl through the Force, but she still couldn't find her.
"What happened here?" Gara asked.
"She must have put a Force bubble around herself," Jaina said.
She looked around, surveying the damage more closely.
"Looks like it deflected the bulk of the blast away from above."
She reached out cautiously with her hand, feeling for the bubble, and was surprised to find nothing there.
"It must have closed when she passed out."
Gower moved to the girl's side and rolled her over. Tahiri turned without resistance and lay on her back with her eyes open.
"Tahiri?"
The Rin felt for a pulse in her throat when there was no response. "She's alive." Jaina tried to reach her through the Force one more time.
"Tahiri?"
Nothing.
Jaina had never felt anyone so empty before. The girl felt hollow in the Force, almost... She stopped the thought, not wanting to introduce the idea into her mind, but it was too late. Almost invisible, she thought, like the Yuuzhan Vong. Jaina's comlink beeped.
Jaina?
Her mother's voice came again over the comlink. She turned away from Tahiri and raised her comlink.
Yes, Mom? Rescue teams have reached the epicenter of the blast.
Looking up, she could see movement through the hole.
We're directly below. Are you with them?
Yes. They started pulling bodies out of the rubble. A sickening sensation swept through her. If she'd only acted faster, not wasted time assuming the bomb could be defused.
How many?
She asked.
Four so far, and...
Leia's hesitation told her there was worse to come.
What is it, Mom? It's Prime Minister Kundertal. He's dead.
Jaina looked down into Tahiri's empty, almost accusing eyes. The hollowness she exhibited was catching.
Jaina, did you hear me? I heard you, Mom. I'm on my way up.
Garrett took Tahiri into his arms, and together they negotiated the rubble. As they reached the surface, Melinza's words about the cosmic balance came back to haunt her. Good works lead to evil results. Jaina had been trying to do the right thing, but it had all gone so terribly wrong. Salkelli had betrayed her. Zell and Yorg were dead. Tahiri was unconscious. The Prime Minister had been murdered. All of this, despite her best efforts. It wasn't just her, either. Uncle Luke had liberated the Bakarans from the Empire only to see them turn their backs on the Galactic Alliance. The New Republic had created the Bakaran Defense Fleet to protect the planet from the Syruk, but half of it had been destroyed elsewhere in the galaxy, leaving Bakara vulnerable again. Bakara had never been the aggressor, yet bad things kept happening to it. No wonder its people were eager to look for alternatives. And what if the treaty with the Pwek did turn out to be legitimate, she asked herself. What then? What evil might that reap farther down the track for the planet? They clambered out into the daylight and saw the small knot of people gathered around the Prime Minister's body, looking down in shock and horror. The large man lay sprawled out on a repulsor gurney, the scorched remains of his ceremonial robes torn down the center, where a meditech had struggled unsuccessfully to revive him. Leia's attention was fixed on the Prime Minister's body and the activities taking place around it, but she looked up to acknowledge Jaina. She was pale beneath sooty smudges that covered her face. Her expression was one of abhorrence, and her eyes were filled with tears and pain. Reports were garbled from below, but the sense of disaster was all too vivid for Jag's liking. Relayed from commentators and unofficial sources through Salonia to him, there was a lot of room for misinformation. There had been some sort of explosion during the consecration ceremony. Something had muffled the blast, though, according to commentators on the ground, and thankfully the damage to the intended target wasn't as extensive as it could have been. Nevertheless, two senators were dead, along with half a dozen guards and a couple of guests. 40 more had incurred wounds, with injuries ranging from hearing loss to loss of limbs. And, of course, there was Kundertal himself. "Kata!" he spat. The Chiss rarely expressed emotions vocally, but they did have words for it when the occasion arrived. Assassination was an ugly tactic, no matter who employed it, and if this turned out to be the work of terrorists hoping to disrupt the consecration ceremony, he was sure that retaliation would be swift and brutal. It hadn't been terrorists, some of the uglier rumors said, but the Deputy Prime Minister himself. Jaina's reappearance had brought some comfort, briefly. She had only confirmed everyone's worst fears. Blaine Harris had set the bomb, hoping to incriminate the Galactic Alliance and make a martyr out of Melinza Thanis, as well as getting Kundertal out of the way. The implications of this stunned Jag, and he shook his head at the thought. With Kundertal dead and Harris likely to face any number of charges, Bakra had effectively been stripped of its highest levels of command. On the heels of that thought came an announcement from Pride of Salonia.
"We've just had word from Sentinel," Captain Maine said. "General Panib has declared martial law. He's requested that, no matter what happens, we don't take any direct action. Word is filtering down the chains of command on both sides. He's not exactly sure what the Kiramak will make of this yet, but we're picking up activity on the Salistar spaceport where the Prek ships are parked. My guess is they're not going to sit around and do nothing while bombs go off around their precious leader."
Jag agreed. It made sense that they would pull out and try again later. There had been no mention that the ceremony had to be performed at a specific time, so presumably there'd be no problem with picking up and carrying on from where they left off later.
"What do you want us to do?"
he asked Maine.
"Just back off a little. This is a touchy time. Whatever this honor guard is really about, we're just going to have to leave them to it for a while."
"Understood."
He relayed the order to his pilots and changed the vector of his own wing, letting the trio they'd been following drift slowly away. Now more than ever, he wanted to ask for permission to land, not only to help out with things on the surface of the planet, but also, and more importantly, so that he could be with Jaina. As soon as Tahiri was strapped safely onto a repulsor gurney, Gaur joined the rescue effort. Han raised an eyebrow at the sight of the Rin, but was too grateful for the extra set of hands to question his presence. Two people had been caught under the rubble, and, with the help of hastily improvised repulsor sleds, the rescue was only slowly unfolding. Jaina lent her efforts where she could, using the Force to search the rubble pile for weak points, applying pressure where those on the outside couldn't reach, and shoring up the healing energies of the victims who couldn't be treated immediately. But it didn't feel enough. In the first minutes after the explosion, as panic prompted a mass evacuation of the area, chaos and confusion kept emergency services at a distance. The few who did get through, some of them dropping down from air cars with med packs on their backs, worked harder than they probably had in their entire lives. Beneath a foreboding sky, darkened further by a thick pall of smoke hanging over the stadium, the Prek bodyguards had tightened their ranks around the Kiramak. The multicolored Cyruvi mutant watched on from the safety of this vantage point, its expression unreadable as it surveyed the carnage. Jaina had barely had the chance to do more than hug her mother and father in relief at seeing them again. It was only later, when medical reinforcements arrived, that she had time to actually step back and take a proper look at the world around her. Everyone was covered in dust and splattered with blood. Where the two met, they made a dirty red paste. The survivors had a shocked look in their eyes, even those who helped in the rescue. Senators and security guards were suddenly on the same level, united by the terrible tragedy that had taken place around them. No one paid any mind to the thunderstorm that was brewing overhead. It seemed almost irrelevant in the face of what had happened. But there was something else that wasn't as easy to ignore, a sound that nagged at her from below the rumbling of the crowd. It was a strange and haunting wail, an ululation that seemed in search of a note of despair, but couldn't quite find it. Her father looked up, frowning. "You hear that, Leia?" Leia turned in disbelief.
"They've started again."
Jaina followed her gaze to the heart of the stadium. Sure enough, the ceremony had recommenced. She could see lithe reptilian aliens dancing in a circle, and one multicolored shape prowling the center, uttering noises that sounded like the angry song of some mighty bird.
"What is this?" she asked.
"They're going to finish the job," Han said, the stubble on his chin flecked with dust. "You've got to admire their persistence, don't you?"
"Admire them?" Jaina thought.
"Hardly. If anything, it was incredibly insensitive. Even over the sound of rubble shifting and the moans of those in pain, the strange sounds coming from the Prek set her teeth on edge.
"I don't understand," she said. "Why would the Kiramak finish it now, when it would obviously be safer later?"
"They're aliens," a nearby Meditech said. "Who's to say what goes on in their heads?"
3PO, Leia said. "Translate for me, will you?"
The protocol droid stood up from where he'd been lifting chunks of rock and placing them into a hamper. He tilted his head to listen properly to the growing cacophony. "The gulfs of space are not home to us," he translated, "and neither are the barren worlds. The worlds of fire and the worlds of ice are not home to us, where oxygen burns and water flows, where carbon bonds and ozone protects. There we plant our roots. The seed of our species is fertile. All we require is the soil in which to plant it."
"More of the same, in other words," Han said. "But I still don't understand their urgency to get the ceremony finished with all this chaos around them."
Jaina remembered what Harris had said earlier about the similarities between the Sairuk and the Yuuzhan Vong. The warriors of the Yuuzhan Vong wouldn't consider going into battle without making appropriate sacrifices to Yun Yamka. The Sairuk, in turn, were loath to risk their souls on a world that hadn't been consecrated. Perhaps the sudden carnage around them made them want to get the ceremony finished as quickly as possible, just in case more attacks were to follow. She found it hard to understand the logic that drove such notions. The Force didn't demand sacrifice, nor favor one location over another. It simply was, in and surrounding all things. Jaina's thoughts came back to Melinza's words on the swinging of cosmic scales. She had to bring her parents up to speed on what had happened to the young activist, and she also wanted to ask Gower where he fit into everything. There were other, more pressing matters to consider, too, not the least of them being what the Bokhran government would do once things settled down. Would they put Melinza Thanis back behind bars, or Jaina herself for having helped the girl escape? Without objective witnesses to Harris's treachery, an investigation could drag on for ages. And then there was Tahiri. Good works lead to evil results. Tahiri's brainwashing at the hands of the Yuuzhan Vong shaper, Meijian Quad, had been a terrible thing, but her rescue and apparent recovery had balanced that out. Anakin's growing love for her had been cancelled out by his death. Where did that leave her now? The reemergence of the Rena Quad personality was only going to make things worse, surely. If there was a balance in the galaxy, when was it going to swing again in Tahiri's favor? Jaina's thoughts were distracted when the sound of engines whining joined the chanting. It was growing steadily louder. Jaina looked around, then up. Emerging smoothly from the clouds were three Dekee-class Pwek troopships. Bulbous around the middle and tapering to a fine point at the stern, they slowly descended toward the stadium. The huge canopy flag ripped beneath the landing struts of one of the ships. Its tattered remnants flapped chaotically in the wind. "Reinforcements?" Han asked of no one in particular. Some of the stadium crowd had defied security after the explosion and spilled into the center space, waving placards angrily. Jaina wondered if they thought the Pwek were behind the crisis. The Pwek, armed with paddle beamers, were more than capable of keeping the crowd back, but they must have been aware that the crowd could easily grow larger and more hostile if provoked. "A quick getaway, perhaps," Jaina suggested. "They might be keen enough to consecrate in the middle of all this, but I doubt that they'd want to stick around afterward." "You could be right, honey," her father said. Jaina was struck by conflicting impressions of him. How old he was getting, and how much more alive he looked when the going got tough. He might sweat and fidget through diplomatic negotiations, but when things took a turn for the physical, he was often the first into the fray. The alien vessels rotated in midair when they were over the stadium and descended at a safe distance from the ring of Pwek guards. The sound of engines had risen to an almost painful level, and the Bokhrans below quickly scattered, shaking fists into the air as they ran. The noise drowned out any protest they made. Dekee-class ships were small as far as spacecraft went, but still four stories high from base to tip. "Excuse me, mistress," C-3PO said. "Look," Han said, shouting over the growing din. "Three more." She shaded her eyes and looked where he was pointing. Another trio of ships was descending beyond the stadium walls, the same type of troop ship as those that had just landed.
"What are they doing?" Leia asked.
Jaina recognized the edge to her mother's tone. She, too, was starting to have misgivings about all this. "If I might interrupt, mistress," 3PO tried again, gesticulating off to one side. He was desperately trying to make himself heard, but the racket was smothering most of what he was saying. Suddenly, the engines from all three of the ships in the stadium below cut out, allowing a relative quiet to settle around the area. The chanting had ceased also, and the Kirimak was now standing in the middle of his enormous entourage, glinting as though wearing rainbow-tinted armor. The guards stood with their tails flat to the ground, paddle beamers held at the ready across their chests. For a moment, everything was still. Then, with one eye on what was taking place with the Pwek, Jaina leaned toward C-3PO and muttered,
"What was that you just said, 3PO?"
"The ceremony is complete, mistress," the golden droid said. "Thanks, Goldenrod," Han said. "But that seems pretty obvious from where I'm standing.
But, sir, I've been trying to explain that the ceremony required the Kirimak to give Bakura a new name.
Shui." Leia faced him fully now.
"Did he happen to mention this fact to the Bakurans before he did it?"
"I doubt that very much, mistress," C-3PO said. "You see, the Kirimak has also dedicated Shui to the Cyruvi Imperium."
Han and Jaina also turned to look at C-3PO now. As if in response to the droid's words, a peal of thunder rumbled from the tropical sky. Fat raindrops began to splatter his metal cranium, turning what dust was there to a reddish mud.
"3PO, are you sure about this?" Leia asked.
"Oh, quite certain. In fact, it was stated several times and in different ways. As the glorious Cyruvi Imperium, the majestic Cyruvi Imperium, the boundless and incomparable Cyruvi Imperium."
Han turned to Leia, speaking over the top of C-3PO.
"Couldn't this just be part of the ceremony? Something carried over from the old ways? I mean, we still talk about the New Republic instead of the Galactic Alliance. Maybe their new Cyruvi Imperium has nothing at all to do with the old one."
"I don't think so," Leia said. "Look at the ships."
Rain began to fall in great sheets across the stadium as the sides of the troop ships opened, issuing ramps. Jaina squinted to see through the rain, trying to make out what lay inside. Dull brown paint was falling away in the rain, revealing golden scales, the sign of the Cyruvi priest caste. Relieved of the need for concealment, the priest's postures straightened, shrugging off the hunch of years of supposed servility and adopting the cold, straight-backed pride Jaina remembered from Hollows. Realization struck her like a physical blow. Of course! The treaty with the Pwek was a smokescreen for the real tactic. Once Bakura belonged to the Cyruk, once it was consecrated, they could advance on it in force.
"This can't be good,"
Han said as columns of russet-scaled Cyruvi warriors began marching out of the nearest troop ship. Jag's frustration immediately increased when, at the peak of the consecration ceremony, the feed from the ground dissolved in a burst of static. All transmissions from the planet ceased, sending white noise blistering through his ears. He quickly checked his comm and ascertained that the problem wasn't on board. It lay outside his clawcraft.
"Salonia, I seem to have a communications outage. Anything coming through from your end?"
"Negative, Twin One," came the reply, distorted but comprehensible. "We've lost our uplink, too. Hold on while we look into it."
Jag waited anxiously, with only the persistent static to listen to. Then, amid the crackly hissing, he heard another noise. It was like a wailing, constantly fading in and out. It was unsettling, both haunting and hypnotic at the same time.
"I have launches!"
The voice of one of his pilots jolted him out of his reverie.
A quick glance at his board confirmed the report. The nearest of the two Pwek carriers, Erinunka, was disgorging dozens of smaller vessels into the space around it. His computer instantly recognized and marked the familiar droid fighters, but that proved to be only half the complement of the new ships. The rest were of a type never before seen outside the borders of the Cyruk Imperium. They were Vasette-class fighters, and if his memory served him well, they possessed twice the firepower of ordinary droid fighters, as well as a superior maneuverability. Most importantly, though, they carried flesh-and-blood pilots. It took him only a moment to figure out what was going on. The Prek's offer of peace had been completely bogus.
The consecration of the planet had been nothing more than a means to clear the way for an invasion force. It didn't take a genius to know that things were about to get very nasty very quickly.
Twin Suns full alert. Salonia, are you registering this?
We have it on our scopes now, trying to raise General Panib. Communications are out down there, too.
The transmission dissolved into static again. The voice returned briefly with, "Be jammed somehow, be on..." The signal vanished beneath a howl of rising interference. Jag turned down the gain. What next? They had enemy ships pouring onto the scan, and, as yet, no response from the local forces. Between himself and the enemy were the mixed flights comprising the Bakaran Pwek Honor Guard, now numbering in excess of 200. It seemed from the way they were still flying in formation that they hadn't received orders to engage or break away. This surprised Jag. Even if the messages were being jammed, surely one of the Bakaran Honor Guard pilots would have realized by now what was going on. And yet they were all there, flying in perfect formation, completely unaffected by what was happening around them. Clicking his wingmates, he brought his clawcraft around to match the vectors with the nearest trio of Honor Guard fighters. Two droid ships flanked a Bakaran Y-wing in perfect synchrony, shadowing its every move as it swept around the planet. He scanned the formation for energy emissions and soon discovered that shadowing was as far from the truth as it could get. The two droid ships had powerful tractor beams locked on the Y-wing and were forcing it to go where they wanted it. He plotted its course. In two orbits, it would intersect with the carrier Firinri. A cold chill ran through him. The droid ships were kidnapping the pilot. A quick scan confirmed that the same was true of all the other Honor Guard flights. Powerless to resist the Pwek tractor beams, the Bakaran pilots were helpless in the traps sprung on them, and half of the Bakaran's defense fleet was about to be taken down with them. There was no way he could warn Twin Suns, Salonia, and General Panib. However, he wasn't about to sit back and let those pilots be reeled in to be intact. He could only hope that others would understand his actions and follow his lead. Arming his forward batteries, he thrust hard to cut off the droid fighters. A burst from his blaster cannon skittered off shields that were tougher than he'd expected. It weakened them slightly, but there was certainly no penetration. As soon as he'd swept past, one of them broke away to give chase. The first of his wingmates, Twin Six, met it with a hail of laser fire that forced it to change course. It ducked away, although not before sending a spray of energy at Twin Three as it did. The second droid ship and its unwilling charge were making a break for it, abandoning all pretense of cooperation and changing course. Instead of arcing gradually around the planet, the pair headed directly for Firinri. A quick glance at his scopes confirmed that the others were doing the same. The masquerade was over. There was no longer any mistaking the Honor Guard for what it was. Jag lined up behind the fleeing droid fighter and sent a volley of lasers through its weakened shields, quickly reducing it into space dust. The liberated Y-wing instantly changed course, wiggling on its long axis in what Jag took as a gesture of thanks. Twin Two dispatched the other droid fighter and swooped back to join formation. The Y-wing followed, emitting a series of clicks. Jag didn't need any more encouragement than that. Leading a diamond-shaped formation of mixed vessels, he targeted the next Honor Guard trio and closed in. By then, his tactical scopes were full of new targets. The alien carriers had emptied their launching bays, and hundreds of fully fueled fighters were jockeying to protect the inbound captives. A rash of launches from Sentinel and Defender indicated that the Bakaran defense fleet had finally caught on. The sky around Bakara was soon boiling as the two forces clashed over the Honor Guard ships, one half fighting to save them, the other half doing everything in their power to repel the rescue attempt. Jag flew as he hadn't flown in a long time. It felt good to be fighting an enemy who used a technology he was familiar with, even if that enemy easily outnumbered him and his squadron. In a strange way, it felt like he was back at the academy sitting through a simulation, riding out old melees with an instructor on his case. He was pleased that time away fighting the Yuuzhan Vong hadn't eroded the reflexes he'd honed as a child. The manned Vesette fighters were tough kills, though.
Flattened and slightly curved versions of the droid fighters the Cyrook usually sent into battle, these were equipped with shield generators and sensor arrays at every corner. Their engines flashed an eye-piercing violet when powering at max. Their weapons burned a brilliant white. Each pilot hid behind an opaque hull and shields that turned mirror bright every time a shot came too near. It was an earlier version of those shields, Jag had learned in the academy, that the Emperor Palpatine had coveted. Hence his attempts to form a treaty with the Cyrook, just before the rebels had beaten him at Endor. Jag dreaded to think what might have happened had the Emperor's dream come true. If he'd had these shields back then, the rebellion would have undoubtedly been quashed, and the outcome of the Battle of Endor would have been considerably different. Moreover, the Chiss, safe in the unknown regions, might not have been safe for much longer. But the Chiss had fought the Cyruvi fighters before, and, even after years of technical improvements, they were capable of doing so again now. The Set fighters, Jag soon discovered, were vulnerable to multiple attacks. Converging in pairs from different angles was difficult to coordinate without the benefit of effective communications, but all the pilots read the situation similarly, and they managed to struggle through. With a few multiple attacks under their belts, it got steadily easier, and in no time at all, they were taking out Vasset fighters in sufficient quantities to make the Cyrook think twice. Soon, the dense and volatile orbit surrounding Bakra were a massive energy, dangerous for pilots on both sides to navigate through. Seeing one of his squadron's X-wings trying to shake off the Vasset fighter riding its tail, Jag set off in pursuit. He got a lock on the fighter as it dog-tailed after the X-wing, and he fired when he thought he had a reasonable aim, but the fighter suddenly banked left after the X-wing, and the shot went wide. Jag cursed under his breath as he brought the clawcraft back onto the fighter's tail. Before he could line up another shot, two more fighters came at him from his port side, weapons blazing angrily at him. He sucked air through clenched teeth sharply and nosedived away from the incoming fire. Seconds later, when he had chance to look again for the X-wing, he saw it fall apart in a blaze of fire beneath the Vasset's blasters. The two fighters he had just eluded were quickly back on his tail. With the rest of the squadron engaged in the battle elsewhere, he knew that help wouldn't be coming any time soon. He was going to have to make his own luck. Han was backing up, looking for the nearest exit. From below came the sound of screams as the crowd ran in a panic from the advancing aliens. Security guards opened fire on the Cyruvi warriors, who responded with blistering barrages from their paddle beamers. In leaps and bounds, propelled by powerful thigh and tail muscles, the Cyrook soon overwhelmed the Bakaran troops. The Prek guards, who had originally protected the Kirmak from attack, turned out to be genuine Prek, unlike the disguised priests. They protected their leader behind a tight huddle, beamers at the ready. "A tactical retreat might be called for," Jaina suggested to her parents. "Now that Bakara has been consecrated, my guess is that these guys won't be afraid to fight any more." "If we get to the Falcon," Leia said, her Nogri bodyguards closing in around her, watching the Cyruvi warriors balefully, "we'll have a better chance of dealing with this."
"Does Salonia know?"
Han asked.
Leia shook her head.
"Jammed."
Jaina thought of Jag and hoped he was all right. There was no telling what was happening in orbit. If it was anything like what was happening down here on the ground, then it was going to get messy, fast. She wished she were behind the controls of her X-wing, flying at his side. Her only concern, the enemy in her crosshairs. Things were a whole lot simpler in a dogfight. But wishing wasn't going to get her or her family away from here. She needed to act. And quickly. She turned to find Gaur standing at Tahiri's side.
"We need a way out of here," she said.
He looked up at her, his face illuminated sharply by a flash of lightning. "The main exits are going to be blocked," he shouted over the thunder rolling from the sky. Jaina looked around again. The rain was thickening, making it harder to see what was happening in the bowl of the stadium. Paddle beams sizzled through the air, weaving a dense and deadly fabric of energy below. The leading edge was coming rapidly closer. She nodded after a moment.
"I think it's safe to assume that that's what the other three ships were for, to keep us from getting out."
"The way we came, then?"
Lurin pointed at the craterous hole in the stands.
It has to be safer than staying out in the open.
Gina agreed, and together they began to gather up the confused rescue workers and spectators still milling about the area. She explained her intentions as best she could, asking them to trust her as she sent them down into the hole. There was little resistance from the people. In the absence of any other plan, most were more than happy to follow her instructions. Once everyone was in, Han and Leia were to go next, then wait for Gaur to lower Tahiri into the hole on her gurney. Jaina and the Nogri guards would take up the rear to protect everyone's backs.
"What about the Prime Minister?" one of the women asked as she went past Jaina.
"What about him?" she shouted back over the rain.
"He's dead. We can't leave his body here for the Fluties."
"But..." The protest died in her throat.
"Okay, okay, I'll see what I can do."
Leaving her parents to supervise the evacuation, she looked around for the stretcher on which she'd last seen the body. She found it tucked away behind an outcrop, covered in a body bag. If she could slave it to Tahiri's repulsor gurney, maybe they'd be able to take both of them out in tandem. The moment it got in her way, she told herself, then she would cut it loose. The living had to take priority over... Her thoughts stopped in mid-track as she went to move the stretcher. The body bag caught on a twisted seat and pulled away, revealing it to be empty. Her puzzlement was short-lived. Someone else must have had the same concerns and already taken the body to safety. One of the guards or senators, perhaps, who had made a break for it without the others. She didn't care. The problem was no longer hers. That was all that mattered. She returned to the crater where the last of the survivors was disappearing into the hole. Glad that they would soon be making a move, she looked over her shoulder at the battle taking place in the arena below. The rain was heavier than ever, but she could still make out figures moving in groups across the stadium bowl. The blaster fire was becoming increasingly sporadic as Bakker and Resistance failed before the Cyruvi advance. It wouldn't be long now before the stadium belonged to the Cyruk. Soon after, she assumed with a shudder, the captives would be rounded up and taken to the carriers in orbit for entechment. She turned when a hand touched her shoulder. "Come on, Jaina," her father said. "There's nothing more we can do here." Although it galled her to leave the battle, the odds were so overwhelming that she knew she didn't really have a choice. Before she climbed back down into the hole, she cast her eyes up at the cloud-packed sky. "May the Force be with you, Jag," she thought, "wherever you are." Catching sight of the nearer of Bakura's two moons, Jag pulled his clawcraft up and away, aiming with full throttle toward it. He didn't need to look back to know the fighters were following. The space ahead of him was puffing with bright explosions from their misfired shots. He brought the clawcraft in steeply to the northernmost part of the moon, hoping to find some form of cover that might help him evade his pursuers. The closer he drew, the less likely this seemed. He brought his ship around from its almost perpendicular descent, speeding off across the surface of the moon. The ground was smooth and rolling, and looked to Jag to be made of an immense lava flow that had long since cooled. But it offered him no place to hide, and right now, that was all that mattered. He jinked and swerved continuously in a bid to avoid both fire and tractor beams, but he knew he wouldn't be able to keep it up indefinitely. He cursed himself again. This little maneuver of his had put him in a worse situation than he'd been in before. Without warning, the surface of the moon dipped sharply ahead of him, and the smooth ground he'd been following became a motionless waterfall that poured into a huge canyon easily 50 kilometers wide and at least a couple deep. Crags appeared out of the shadows, along with large rocky outcrops that jutted from the walls of the canyon like crimson fists. The Vasset fighters followed effortlessly, no longer trying to shoot him out of the sky. They were obviously intent on capturing him now. They must have realized that eventually they would get him. They just had to be patient. He brought the clawcraft down, getting in as close as possible to the floor of the canyon, swerving frantically to avoid mineral deposits protruding from the canyon floor. 10 meters wide and at least 3 times that high, they looked like enormous petrified trees. And there were plenty of them, too, forcing Jag to bring all his flying experience to bear just to avoid hitting any. It was only when he inadvertently collected one with a shield that he realized it didn't matter whether he avoided them or not. The tree dissolved into a powder that silently washed over his viewport. After this, he didn't even bother trying to fly his way between these bizarre-looking protrusions. He just flew in a straight line, bringing down whatever was in his path. Hopefully, he thought, the resulting dust would be enough to blind his pursuers. Even if it afforded him only a moment or two, at least it would be something. The canyon suddenly narrowed, though, and he knew he would have to climb out sooner rather than later, or wind up smashing straight into a wall. He brought his ship up, aiming for a rocky outcrop on the uppermost ridge of the canyon wall. Two bony fingers of rock stabbed out into the sky, as if pointing to the battle taking place overhead. If he could make it back up to the main battle, he might just be able to get help from the others in the squadron to get these fighters off his tail. Realizing his intentions, the fighters opened fire again. Rock exploded from the canyon wall nearby. Debris rattled against his shields. He aimed between the fingers of rock, but miscalculated the space between them and clipped one on the way through. He called out in alarm as the ship rolled out of control, out into the space above the moon. He emerged from the spin, battered and barely in control. The two vassettes on his tail negotiated the hail of debris and kept coming. He jerked his claw craft from side to side in a desperate attempt to avoid their grasping tractor beams, but his collision with the rocks had allowed them to gain on him. It would only be a matter of seconds now before— A white blur streaked up past his viewport. His sensors barely had time to register the Y-wing as it flew within meters of him, torpedo ports firing. The enemy Cyruvi pilots didn't have time to deactivate their tractor beams before they sucked in the proton torpedoes. One instantly exploded. The second took a hit that sent it spiraling wildly back to the surface of the moon, where it flowered in a brief and silent explosion. Jag's rear scopes were clear again, but his little jaunt into Bakura's moon hadn't come without a price. His damaged thruster complained with a stutter and a whine as he pulled hard around. The Y-wing swooped back to match vectors with him. The pilot, the same one Jag and his wingmates had rescued at the beginning of the battle, waved through her canopy. The gesture had little joy in it, though, and a quick scan told him why. The Bakuran defense fleet was in bad shape. Sentinel had been hit by heavy bombing and its shields were down. Defender was standing defiant but without enough fighters to have any real effect on the battle. The Cyruvi forces rapidly mopped up any fighters it launched. Outnumbered and taken by surprise, Bakura lay open to attack. In complete contrast, the two giant Schneer-class planetary assault carriers hung shining and impregnable above the battlefield. Their impenetrable shields had repelled everything thrown at them. Clusters of captured ships of all shapes hung nearby, waiting to be processed. Denied the basic dignity of dying in battle, hundreds of pilots trapped in durasteel coffins had only entechment to look forward to. A triangular formation of seven vassette fighters accelerated over the horizon of the small moon, coming up hard on Jag and the Y-wing. Jag urged his claw craft to go faster, but it had given him everything it could. Seven fully armed ships against his damaged craft and the old Y-wing was a foregone conclusion. The jamming ebbed long enough for him to check in on his squadron. "Twin Suns report," he juked to avoid a crippling energy blast. "Three here, four, six, eight." There was a slight pause. "Jag, they've got me." "And me," Six said. "Looks like I'll have company then," Three said. "They've got me too." Jag cursed. Apart from himself, that left just one pilot free, and he wasn't sure how long he would last. He watched with dismay as the Y-wing tried to dodge the incoming vessels, only to be jerked back in the clutches of seven combined tractor beams. The pilot went without a sound. Either her comm was down or she was sparing him her despair. Jag vowed then and there that he would not share a similar fate. He would sooner blow his engines than allow his soul to be sucked out and squeezed into a battle droid. But how could he do that when there was a chance he and his pilots would escape? While there was life, there was hope. Jag was so frustrated he wanted to scream to get it out of his system.
He almost didn't feel the tractor beams as they wrapped around his struggling clawcraft and started to drag it back into captivity.
Jaina watched from the rear of the column of survivors as they moved along the tunnels under the stadium with only the red glow of emergency lighting to guide them. Despite the ferrocrete around them, she could hear the sound of paddle beamers and screams from up above. Although her lightsaber was still attached to her belt, she kept one hand on the weapon at all times. There was no evidence of immediate trouble, but she knew that pursuit wouldn't be far behind. Lirin led the way, retracing their steps quickly but carefully, with Tahiri's gurney never more than an arm's length away. Water trickled ahead of them in snake-like streams, washing dust and debris down into the depths of the building and making the floor slippery and treacherous.
"I don't think my circuits will stand another minute in this humidity, mistress," C-3PO declared after slipping for the sixth time. The complaint was directed to Princess Leia, but he'd made sure it was loud enough for all to hear.
"Stop your complaining, Goldenrod." Han clapped the droid on the back, producing a metallic echo in the damp tunnel, as well as nearly causing the droid to stumble again. "You've been through worse than this and survived. Remember the incident with the stormtrooper uniform last time we were here?" If 3PO could have shuddered, Jaina was sure he would have done so from the top of his bronzed cranium to the base of his metal soles. "All too well, I'm afraid, sir," he said, his servomotors whirring with each step and his photoreceptor eyes glowing sharply in the gloom. "Mine is not the kind of memory that allows me to forget easily." Jaina stopped listening when she heard a commotion ahead. Her lightsaber was out and ignited before she'd barely taken two steps through the stream of survivors in front of her.
"Princess Leia, Captain Solo, what are you doing here?"
Jaina knew that voice.
"Malinza,"
she said, pushing forward. People made way for the buzzing, glowing blade.
"You should have left long ago. The exit was blocked."
The girl was at the front of the small group, blaster held down at her side. Vyrum stood between her and their captives, a sullen Sol Kelly and a defiant Harris. Both were bound and gagged.
"There are Cyrook everywhere out there."
Jaina turned to Gower.
"Is there another way out of here?"
"I'm not sure." Lirin sounded calm and unflustered, but the lashing of his tail betrayed his nervousness. "But he might know," he said, pointing at Harris. "We followed him in here." She indicated for Malinza to remove his gag.
"Well?"
"Well, what?" he said, eyes blazing with anger.
"Is there another way out of here?"
"Why should I tell you anything? To help you?" He laughed lightly as he shook his head. "Don't imagine that I'll be doing that in a hurry."
"In case you hadn't heard, your plan went horribly wrong. The Prek were just a smokescreen for the Cyrook. You may have killed the Prime Minister, but it didn't stop the consecration. Once it was completed, the invasion force moved in."
Harris noticeably paled in the dim light of the tunnel. "Invasion?" He was at a loss for words, but not for long. "If Kundertal is dead, Bakura will need a strong leader. You might not like my methods, but I can get the job done. Set me free, and—"
"It's too late for that," Jaina said. "There's a good chance you might not survive the next hour, let alone take the Prime Minister's job."
"So now you're in charge?" he sneered. "Is that the way it works, Solo?" He turned to Malinza and the other survivors. "Don't you think it's convenient that the Galactic Alliance is here just in time to save us from a crisis we never knew we had? At a time when—"
"Save it, Harris," Jaina cut in. "No one's listening to you. There's no mistaking what we all saw out there. The Cyrook are on Bakaran soil, and it's partly your fault they're here. You should have made sure of your new allies before selling your soul to them."
"It wasn't him who sold his soul," said a new voice from the shadows farther along the corridor. A tall figure stepped into the light. At first, Jaina didn't recognize him. His blonde hair had been burned away. Bruises and scorch marks blackened his skin. He wore the remains of ceremonial robes around him like rags, concealing his hands. "The market for politicians," Prime Minister Kundertal said, "is perhaps unsurprisingly quite small."
"You?"
Leia couldn't keep the surprise out of her voice.
"But you're
dead?" The big man smiled. "Not quite. Luckily, the blast only stunned me for a time. I woke up down here, disoriented and lost. I heard footsteps from Somalinza, but I didn't want to reveal myself until I knew what she was up to, and what exactly she was doing with Blaine. I thought Freedom might have kidnapped him as well as set the bomb. But I guess I was wrong about you, Malinza, and for that I must apologize." The girl nodded a wary acceptance.
"It was Harris," she said. "He set us up."
"This is impossible," the accused man said. "That bomb was... I mean, they said you were dead."
"Well, they were mistaken."
Kundertal pulled his right hand from beneath his robes to reveal a blaster. "As I was mistaken to put my faith in you, Blaine, I can't believe that you're responsible for everything that's happening to us today." Although the weapon pointed only at Harris, Jaina instinctively tensed. Her lightsaber rose slightly. Leia's Nogri bodyguards also moved, hissing in warning as they placed themselves between Kundertal and the princess. Something about the Prime Minister wasn't quite right. Jaina could sense it, even if she couldn't define it. When she deep-probed him to see if he was a Yuuzhan Vong spy, she encountered a strange texture. His presence was unlike any she'd felt before. As if her instincts and those of her mother's bodyguards weren't enough, she could feel Gower's unease radiating palpably from him. He knew something, she was sure of it, but he couldn't say anything with Kundertal there. She decided to keep her lightsaber activated until she knew exactly what was going on.
"You must forgive our surprise, Prime Minister," Leia said. "But the last hour has been confusing, to say the least. You may have gathered that the Pwek peace plan was a sham for a Cyruvi attack."
He nodded, keeping his eyes on Harris. "The Flutees have obviously been planning this a long time. I don't suppose you have any idea how we can force them back." Jaina winced at the racist reference to the aliens. She'd heard it before, but on the lips of the Prime Minister it sounded especially crass and defensive.
"No doubt the defense fleet and the Salonia are working on something as we speak," Leia replied. "Unfortunately, the comm channels are jammed, and there are Cyruk right behind us. We need to get out of here as quickly as possible. If we can get to the Falcon, that would be ideal."
The Prime Minister nodded. "A sensible plan," he said. "Blaine, you were about to tell us if you knew a way out of here, I believe, before I rudely interrupted." "And I'll say to you what I said to her," the Deputy Prime Minister answered, inclining his head toward Jaina. "Why should I help? The way I see it, I have absolutely nothing to lose." He glared balefully at Kundertal as he raised his arms up in front of him and rattled his binders. "You have your life to lose," Kundertal said simply. "Would you prefer entechment with the rest of us when the Flutees finally catch up?" Harris's glare intensified. "I can't help you, I'm afraid. You see, there is no exit. They're all blocked. Our only hope is to hide in one of the equipment lockers until the Cyruk are gone, and then try to sneak out." "I'm not really one for hiding," Kundertal said, with a regretful shake of his head. The blaster in the Prime Minister's hand fired, and Blaine Harris fell back onto the floor, dead before he hit. "Sorry, my friend, but that was the wrong answer." Jaina stood, stunned, as the blaster came around. Harris had been guilty of mass murder, but she would never condone cold-blooded execution as punishment, and had never expected it from someone like Kundertal. Sol Kelly dropped to his knees in supplication, obviously anticipating a similar fate. Jaina stepped forward to prevent another travesty of justice. However, Kundertal's interest lay not with the Rodian. Instead, in one smooth motion, he pressed the blaster directly against Malinza's temple. "Now, seeing as there are no other options available..." Jaina froze. If she had thought she couldn't be more surprised than she already was, she was quickly proven wrong when the Bokkaran Prime Minister opened his mouth as wide as it would go and called out in Cyruvi language. It consisted of just three notes, but they were so loud even the echoes hurt her ears. An answering reply came almost immediately. Her worst fears realized, Jaina cursed under her breath for allowing herself to be caught like this. She took a step forward, but stopped when Kundertal pushed the blaster even harder against Melinza's temple. Kundertal grinned in triumph. He didn't have to move or say anything. He simply knew that Jaina wasn't about to risk Melinza's life. One squeeze of the trigger, and the girl would be dead. Jaina lowered the lightsaber and tried another tack.
"Let her go."
The mental command accompanying the words would have made an ordinary person instantly obey. But the Prime Minister just shook his head. "I don't think so," he said, smiling.
"What are you?" Jaina asked.
The Prime Minister's smile widened, if that was possible. "New," he said. "But we haven't got time for that right now. We need to go and meet your new masters." Rapid footfalls came down the corridors behind and ahead of them. Deep fluting calls passed back and forth between the two alien search parties as they converged on the maintenance area. The survivors drew closer together, moving instinctively into a corner. Jaina planted herself protectively between them and Kundertal, her eyes on both corridor entrances. Behind her, she felt her father and mother, Gower, and two security guards doing the same. If only they'd rushed Kundertal when they'd had the chance, she thought. If only. She fought herself to stop such thoughts. They were non-productive at best. There'd be time for regrets later. If there was a later, of course.
"You knew about the Syruk,"
Melinza hissed, held tight in his grip. Her voice was steeped in disgust.
"You betrayed Bakara. You're no better than Harris."
"You're wrong on that score, I assure you," Kundertal said. "I am in every way better than Harris." There was no time for Jaina to wonder what he meant. Six Syruvi warriors burst out of the corridor to her left, running with long, bounding strides and flicks of their mighty tails, paddle beamers held before them in taloned hands. Their eyes and scales gleamed red in the emergency lighting. They came to a halt, hissing and screeching at the sight of the fugitives before them. The leader directed a series of piercing notes at Kundertal, who responded fluently in the same language. "3PO?" Han prompted the droid from the corner of his mouth. "I believe it is a standard welcome," the droid said, looking from Kundertal to the Syru. The giant saurian indicated the body of Harris and swished its tail. "Now it is reprimanding the Prime Minister that he has wasted this one." The second party arrived before Kundertal could defend himself. At its head was the largest Syru Jaina had yet seen, a beautiful red female warrior with pronounced ridges running back along her snout and across the top of her skull. She wore a black harness adorned with silver medals that jingled with each step she took, and her nostrils flared when her gaze fell upon Jaina and the others. Behind her came five more warriors of ordinary size, protected by four golden priest-caste Syruk, as well as the Kiramak itself, its brighter colors subdued in the dim light. The large party concluded with a group of Prek warriors that fanned out to cover the entrances. The Kiramak moved forward with muscular grace, its massive jaws snapping as though at imaginary insects. Its gold-scaled servants eyed the Bakarans warily, daring them to speak. No one did. A series of eerie melodic notes then issued from the mutant Syru's mouth. "Surrender now," C-3PO translated, "and I will ensure that, once intact, you will be put to productive tasks."
"We were told you no longer required entechment," Leia said, not attempting to hide the disapproval from her voice. "I suppose that was just another lie."
The Kiramak executed a graceful bow. "One of many, Leia Organa Solo," it replied via C-3PO's translation. "The truth is, however, that we have indeed perfected the entechment process. It is now possible to sustain life energy indefinitely, reducing the need for frequent replenishment. Some energies, such as your own, are too strong to resist. You will enrich us for centuries." Leia's lips tightened. From under her robes, she produced her own lightsaber, something she did only when all attempts at diplomacy had failed. It cast a red light across the face of the Kiramak.
"You shall never have my life energy," she said with menacing determination. "Or mine," Jaina said, adding her voice, along with her blade, to her mother's vow.
The Kirimak backed away, fluting as the guards closed in.
"The Kirimak says as you wish," C-3PO reported.
"Don't be fools," Kundertal said. "Don't you understand what you're being offered?"
"All too clearly," Han growled.
"You're hearing the words, but you're not understanding them. Entekment isn't what you think it is. It's not the end. It's the beginning. It's liberation, not captivity."
"You don't really believe that," Leia said.
Kundertal ignored her, addressing the others instead. "Imagine being the controller of your own droid ship, the heart of an interstellar drive, the overseer of an entire city. Imagine the freedom you will achieve when you've been cut loose from the shackles of flesh and blood. You'll be able to live forever."
"Freedom?"
Jaina echoed.
"We'll be slaves.
Immortal slaves. What are a few years of servitude in exchange for eternity? They will pass as though mere moments." Suddenly it became all too clear why Kundertal had betrayed Bakura to the Syruk.
"Is that what they've promised you?" Leia asked. "Immortality? You sold out your planet and people for a promise of longer life?"
Kundertal's smile was wide and amused. "Actually, Princess, they didn't promise me anything. I worked it out for myself. They didn't come to me seeking a bargain. We met halfway. From there, it was just a matter of working out the details."
Jaina shook her head. "Surely you can't be that naive. If you think it's going to happen like..."
"Not going to happen. It's already happened. If you refuse to accept the truth of it, then I cannot help you. Your fate is already sealed." The Kirimak clicked its claws, and half the Pwek moved forward through the ranks of Syruvi guards. If there was going to be a fight, then clearly these were to be sacrificed first. Jaina felt sick to her stomach. As bad as it was to be facing captivity and entekment, it felt worse to know that her only hope of escaping would mean having to fight and possibly kill slaves. Lwathan, even more fidgety than usual, led the contingent. He turned to the Kirimak and inclined his head in what Jaina took to be a gesture of respect and subservience. The mighty Syru uttered a deep, powerful warble that she didn't require C-3PO to translate for her. As far as she was concerned, it could have meant only one thing. The Kirimak was ordering the Pwek guards to subdue the prisoners. Lwathan nodded his long, reptilian head and raised himself to full height. Jaina tensed, her lightsaber igniting with the press of her thumb as she braced herself for the assault. With a cry that both surprised and terrified her in equal measures, Lwathan brought up his paddle beamer and fired point blank. The engines of Jag's clawcraft were running hot. Despite that, it was still firmly tethered to the Vasset fighters that had captured him and being drawn inexorably toward a growing knot of captured Bakoran and Galactic Alliance vessels. Comprised of more than 100 fighters, the knot was being drawn through a narrow hole in the shields of the massive carrier Erinunka. Two Fossen picket ships accompanied them, making certain there was no trouble. The vast, curving sweep of the carrier's bow loomed over him, making him and his fate seem powerfully insignificant. Clicks came over the comm as he joined the formation of captured fighters. Bound tight by powerful tractor beams, all he and his squadron mates could do was signal each other as they were dragged to their doom. Nearby, he could make out the pilot of the Y-wing in her cockpit, hands visibly poised over her controls, a grim expression on her face. Jag had no doubt from the look in her eyes as she stared through her cockpit canopy at him that, given the opportunity, she would fight back. To the death, if need be. Her eyes held the same dark determination he felt in his heart. Not that such an opportunity would eventuate. Once they were on the other side of those shields, that would be it. There would be no hope of rescue then. "I'm sorry, Father," he thought, wishing there was some way that Baron Suntirfel could hear him. And his mother. They'd had such hopes for him. All his life he had struggled to prove himself worthy in their eyes. The slow-maturing child of aliens in a fiercely competitive society, growing up in the shadow of Thrawn and his father's ambition. How could he ever have suspected that he would meet such a fate as this?
"This is Captain Maine,"
the voice came clearly over the comm unit.
"I'm addressing you on an open frequency.
The jamming has been interrupted to let me relay orders from the ground. All fighters must stand down, or planetary bombardment will begin immediately. They have paralysis weapons that can knock out an entire city. Salus Dar will be the first target. Therefore, in the best interest of innocent civilians, I am asking for all resistance to cease.
Jag listened to the words with growing amazement. Could this really be Toad Remain speaking? The thought of just giving in to the Cyrook turned his insides to water.
"If we stand down now, Captain, then they're as good as dead anyway," Jag said over the same frequency. "We have an assurance from the Cyrook that, once the planet is under Imperium control, we shall be treated fairly."
Jag jerked the yoke of his ship to fight the dreadful tug of the tractor beams.
"Like the Pwek War, you mean? As breeding stock for droid fighters? Anything is better than dying."
He could tell by the way his engines were shrieking that they weren't going to last much longer at full throttle. If he was going to blow them, to end it quickly rather than in the mental cage of a droid fighter, then he was going to have to do it soon, while he still had engines to do it with.
"You have to trust me, Jag." Captain Main's voice was thick with tension. "They have Jaina."
"So?" He wanted to yell back at her. "Is one life worth more than that of an entire planet?"
But he couldn't say it. His heart tore at the idea that Jaina might be hurt. With numb fingers, he throttled back and let the alien shield slip over his craft. The shield itself was invisible to all but his instruments, but he imagined it as the maw of some mighty beast waiting to swallow him. Once ingested, fierce gastric juices would remove his soul and dispense with his useless carcass afterward. Then the barrier slammed shut behind them, and they were inside. In the awkward stillness and silence, it felt like an entirely different universe. Outside, beyond the barrier, skirmishes lit up the starry backdrop as pockets of resistance still fought the Cyruvi invaders. The picket ships, once they had delivered their cargo, returned to patrolling the area. Inside the Arenunca's shield, there was only stillness. Caught in the web cast by droid and Vasset fighters, the captives could do little more than curse their misfortune and wait. Everything suddenly stopped as the Kirimak, without a single noise of complaint, crumpled to the floor. There was a split second during which the Cyrook were so stunned by Lwathan's actions that they did nothing at all. They simply stood there, gawping at the Kirimak lying on the ground, oozing a gray, viscous fluid from the paddle-beamer wound in its chest. The Pwek were quick to take advantage of the Cyrook's confusion, and other paddle-beamers began to flash in the dimly lit tunnel. For a moment Jaina was confused, too, but that didn't last. It was obvious what was happening. Lwathan and the Pwek were rebelling against their Cyruvi masters. The Cyrook were better trained and better equipped than the Pwek, though, and they soon regained the advantage, fighting back with frightening ferocity. Jaina had no doubt as to whose side she was on, and when a Cyruvi warrior leveled his beamer at Lwathan, she quickly slashed out with her lightsaber and knocked the weapon from the creature's hand. It swung around, attacking her with three raking claws, and she barely managed to duck a decapitating blow. The Saurian was huge, but she had sparred with Saba Sebatine enough times to know the kind of things a tail could do in combat. And there was still the Force, guiding her every move, tweaking her instincts. Fighting the Cyrook, thankfully, wasn't like fighting the Yuuzhan Vong, whose every intention was hidden from view. She ducked and rolled, kicking up into the Cyru's midriff. It whuffed explosively and staggered backward. It used its tail to keep its balance, swiftly regaining its footing and lunging at her again. But she was out of the way before it could strike out, rolling under its sweeping talons once again. She came around its side, two-handedly slicing across the creature's neck. It fell to the floor with a shriek, spraying blood. Another warrior howled and tried to skewer her with a shot from its beamer. Her lightsaber was unable to deflect the beam as effectively as it would a laser shot, but she did manage to bend it harmlessly into a wall. A Pwek leapt onto the warrior's back and brought it down. Jaina pulled the beamer from its grasp and threw it over to Vyrum, who deftly snatched it from the air and aimed it at Kundertal's face. He fixed the Prime Minister with an unflinching stare.
I won't hesitate to pull this trigger if that blaster so much as gives Melinza a bruise.
Neither moved as the fracas around them came to a surprisingly quick conclusion. The shock of their leader's death seemed to eat at the Cyrook's initial confidence. As the last of the surviving warriors allowed herself to be subdued, the Prime Minister lowered his weapon to his side.
"You ruined it," he said, looking emptily down at the Kiramak. "You ruined it for all of us."
"Yeah," Hans said, looking around at the Puek collecting weapons and distributing them among the Bokkarans. The paddle beamers were awkward to handle, but having something to fight with was better than nothing at all.
"I don't see anyone else complaining."
The advance leader of the Puek Emancipation Movement spoke urgently in his lyrical voice. "Lawthan asks that you contact our fighters immediately," C-3PO translated. "He says that the jamming has been interrupted to allow you to speak."
"What am I supposed to tell them?" Leia asked.
Lawthan sang again.
"Oh my," 3PO said.
"He wants you to tell them to offer no resistance, to allow them to be captured."
Leia opened her mouth, but her husband spoke his mind first.
"No one's giving any such order."
Lawthan explained his plan as best he could in the limited time. When he had finished, Jaina watched Leia glance down at the body of the Kiramak, the look in her eyes suspicious and dubious.
"How can I be sure that you're not asking me to send those fighters into a trap?"
"You cannot," the Puek sang in reply via C-3PO. "But if you say nothing, then those pilots are as good as dead anyway. This is their only hope."
The Puek's eyes were luminous behind their rapidly flickering triple eyelids.
"The time for lies and traps has passed. We stand before you now as allies and equals. We will not betray you."
Every instinct in Jaina's body screamed out to believe him. For the first time, she felt as though they had reached the heart of the conspiracy surrounding Bokkara. Leia clearly felt the same. With a brisk nod, she activated her comlink and called, "Pride of Salonia." The conversation was brief and to the point. The next message Jaina heard over the comlink was Captain Maine's general broadcast to all the Galactic Alliance fighters.
"This is Captain Maine. I'm addressing you on an open frequency."
When she was finished, Jag's voice came back with, "If we stand down now, Captain, then they're as good as dead anyway." At the sound of his voice, something inside Jaina suddenly relaxed. When Lawthan had described the fighting taking place in orbit above Bokkara, her first thought had been of Jag, wondering whether he had been among those killed, or worse, captured for entechment.
"I have an assurance from the Cyrook," Maine went on, maintaining the pretense of surrender, "that once the planet is under Imperium control, we shall be treated fairly."
"Like the Puek were, you mean? As breeding stock for droid fighters?"
"Anything is better than dying."
There was a high-pitched groan over the open line, as though a fighter undergoing stresses it hadn't been designed for. Jaina waited for Jag's reply, but it didn't come. She could feel his uncertainty and desperation as though he were standing next to her. His concern for her burned like a small but intense star. Captain Maine clearly sensed it, too.
"You have to trust me, Jag," she said. "They have Jaina."
The lie cut Jaina deeply, but she knew immediately that it was the right thing to say. If anything could make Jag defy his deepest, most ingrained instincts, then that would be it. His concern for her ran deep, deeper than he had admitted aloud. He didn't reply, but she knew that he had capitulated.
"I presume you know what you're doing, Princess," the voice of Captain Maine added on a private channel.
Leia adjusted the comlink to reply on that same channel.
"I do, Todra."
She glanced at Lawthan with the threat of murder in her eyes.
"Trust me on this."
Time seemed to have frozen. Caught in the web of the Cyruvi shields, Jag vibrated with tension. He had no way of knowing what was happening on the ground or elsewhere in orbit. The jamming had returned not long after the end of Maine's transmission. He felt isolated and powerless, like all the other pilots trapped in their fighters around him, waiting for their captors to move in and take them. Then something strange happened. His sensors registered a slight lessening of the tractor beams holding him in place. Suspecting that some of the Cyruvi escort may have dropped away now that they were safe within the shields, he checked his scope. Their escort hadn't moved. A second later, the tractor beam readings dropped again. He flexed his controls and found that his clawcraft had retained a measure of mobility. He sat for a moment, fighting the impulse to pull loose. What was the point? If he did break free, what was he supposed to do? The shields around the carrier would stop him from escaping anyway, so it seemed a pointless exercise. But then, there was yet another dip in the readings, and this time he couldn't help himself. He found his hopes rising. It couldn't just be him, surely. The grip of the Cyruk on their captives was slipping. A rush of excitement thrilled through him as he realized what must be going on. The Pwek droid ships that had accompanied the Bokoran fighters on the Honor Guard flights were slowly redirecting their tractor beams. Having delivered an undamaged attack force behind the shields of the enemy, they were now setting them free, gradually, so the Cyruk wouldn't notice. The Pwek were rebelling against their masters, for real this time, and using Bokoran firepower as their weapon. Jag clicked three times in rapid succession to call for attention. The captured Twin Sun pilots clicked in immediately. There was a growing rustle over the comm, indicating that others were noticing the change and wondering what was going on. He didn't have much time. He would have to act fast before the Cyruk noticed. When the tractor beams dropped once more, he clicked twice, then twice again. It was the squadron's code for attack, and the response was instantaneous. Jag and his pilots pushed their ships from a standing start to full throttle at virtually the same instant. Tearing free of the weakened forces binding them, they roared out of formation and swooped around to attack the unprepared Cyruk. The Vasset fighters were, much to their surprise, caught in the droid ship's tractor beams, reducing their maneuverability. Within seconds it was over. The Cyruk were destroyed and the tractor beams holding the remainder of the captives fell away completely. The formation immediately dissolved into chaos. Communications cleared. Jag opened his comm on all frequencies, hoping to regain order before the jamming returned. "Stay calm, people," he ordered. "Maintain your original formations. Do not fire on the droid ships. I repeat, do not fire on the droid ships. They're piloted by the Pwek, remember, and they're on our side. They were the ones who got us here." "What's so good about here?" one of the Bokoran pilots returned. "Here we have a target," Jag replied, turning his clawcraft in the direction of the alien carrier. "We're inside the shields, and their squadrons are outside. They can't call for reinforcements without opening themselves up for attack from Salonia or Sentinel." He grinned in anticipation of the battle ahead. It was so obvious now that he saw it. "They've given us a chance, people, so let's not waste it." The dramatic triple reversal of the Pwek, from enemy to ally, then to enemy, and now back to ally, left the Bokoran pilots understandably confused, but they obeyed Jag's orders and left the Pwek alone. Flights of threes and fives reformed and swooped down from the inner edge of the shields to attack the carrier. Jag gathered the remnants of Twin Suns around him and did the same. The carrier bays weren't completely empty, and a dozen Vasset fighters soon rose to meet them. Six droid fighters came in close pursuit. Caught from behind, the Cyruk's defensive charge was soon scattered. "Go for the tractor beam generators," Jag instructed, the pilots swarming around him, searching for targets. "Then make strafing runs across the deflector shield projectors. Try to keep structural damage to a minimum. We have friends in there, and I'd rather not lose a single one of them to friendly fire." Then he was down in the maelstrom, finding targets and launching laser bolts as fast as he could. He made a couple of passes at the ion cannons that ringed the carrier's bulging waist and managed to destroy three. Others from his squadron cleaned up the rest. The response from the carrier was sluggish, and he put that down to the Pwek, who were revolting both inside and outside the ship. But he wasn't fool enough to believe that this advantage would last indefinitely. At 750 meters long, the carrier would have been a formidable opponent for even 100 fighters. Still, he thought, any amount of damage they could inflict upon the carrier would be something. The more they could do here, he figured, the less work there'd be for Jaina later. Word of the breakout of the Galactic Alliance fighters came from Salonia within moments of the airwaves clearing. Jaina, however, had no time to hear the details. A sudden blur of motion caught her attention. Thinking that one of the Cyruvi captives had made a break for it, she whirled with her lightsaber at the ready, but instead all she saw was the back of the former Prime Minister sprinting off down the corridor. Viram was lying on his back, rubbing his right forearm. "I'm sorry," he said, clambering to his feet. He moved so quickly. Jaina didn't wait. She immediately set off after Kundertal. They couldn't let him escape. If he got to a communicator, the plan would be exposed and Jag could be captured for real. She followed the rapid pad-pad of his footsteps along the dusty corridors as he looped around the others and headed up toward the hole Harris's bomb had blown in the stadium. She soon realized what Viram had meant about the Prime Minister being quick. Kundertal's speed was impressive. The sound of his footsteps ahead veered off in a new direction. Two corners and 50 meters later, she understood why. A squadron of Pwek, who had overthrown their masters, came down the tunnel toward her, blocking the exit to the stadium. Kundertal hadn't wanted to run into them, so he had ducked down an alternate tunnel, probably heading for the exit Melinza and the others had tried before. Jaina didn't hesitate. She turned down into the tunnel, too, startling the Pwek squadron as she ran past, but not stopping to explain herself. Jaina could hear Kundertal running downstairs, two floors below. His footfalls were heavy and, incredibly, unflagging. The source of his strength and endurance concerned her. Even she was beginning to tire, despite having the force to augment her stamina. A door slammed somewhere up ahead of her, and she knew that Kundertal had left the stairwell on the 5th basement level. She made herself run faster, hurling herself forcibly at the door when she reached it. The door had barely begun to swing back when something struck out at her from the gloom on the far side. She knocked it aside with a reflexive force shove and rolled away. As she got to her feet and adopted a defensive stance, she had just enough time to make out Kundertal at the far end of a wide corridor. Something whizzed through the air toward her. She moved her head just as a small bolt ricocheted off the wall behind her, leaving a deep dent. Her first thought was that he was using a slingshot, but his hands were clearly empty. She didn't have time to dwell on it, though, as another bolt whizzed by her head, so close that she could feel it flick her hair. "He's throwing them," she thought, incredulous. His strength might have been superior to his aim, but she wasn't about to give him a chance to practice. She sent a force push that would have thrown an ordinary man off his feet. All it did to Kundertal, though, was make him stagger backward. It wasn't much, but it was enough. She ran across the open space before he recovered. He had no intention of sticking around to fight. Instead, he disappeared through yet another door with disconcerting speed. She followed, but more cautiously this time. What was he? Where was he getting his strength and speed from? Whatever was going on, it was obvious she wasn't going to be able to catch him with speed alone. She was going to have to try something else. His footsteps receded down another corridor, then abruptly stopped. Jaina hesitated at the corner, warily peering around it. The dark corridor seemed empty, but she knew he was down there somewhere. "You must know you're not going to get away with this, Kundertal," she called, hoping to get at least an estimate of his position from a reply. "No," he responded. His voice was muffled by something other than just distance. "And I suppose you're going to stop me, girl?"
"That's my intention, yes."
She frowned, unable to place him. "I'm afraid that the best intentions can often count for nothing," he said, suddenly dropping down behind her. "Not when survival is at stake." She spun around to strike out at him, but he knocked her aside as if she were nothing more than a rag doll. His speed and strength were far beyond those of an ordinary man. She shoved off the wall and came back at him with a strike to the head, igniting her lightsaber with the other hand as she did so. He was under the blow before it could connect, punching up at her and knocking her off her feet. She flew 5 meters through the air, her lightsaber inscribing a wide, black arc on the floor as she fell. But she didn't let go of it. Kundertal didn't want to waste time with talk. The twisted expression on his face told her that he was concerned with only one thing. Escape. As long as she stood between him and that goal, she would have to be eliminated.
She backflipped onto her feet before he could reach her, and warned him away with a swing of her lightsaber. He feinted to her left, then came at her from her right, ducking under the blade and delivering a blow to her chest that felt as though she'd been hit by a force pike. She flew off her feet again and landed on her backside with a painful grunt. This time, her grip on the lightsaber failed and the weapon went skittering across the floor. Before she could snatch it back with the force, Kundertal had already stepped up to finish her off. "You put up a good fight," he said, looking threateningly over her.
"It isn't over yet," she returned, summoning the lightsaber back toward her.
It shot through the air with a whine and a hiss. Hearing it coming, Kundertal rolled away to one side, but not before the sizzling blade connected. He fell back with a roar, clutching his injured arm. Jaina used the moment to climb back onto her feet, albeit with some difficulty. Her legs were weak from Kundertal's attack, and the world seemed to be swaying crazily around her. Nevertheless, she managed to hold her ground, directing her thoughts once again out to the lightsaber. This time it flew straight back into her hand. Kundertal, however, had already taken flight. She could see him at the end of the corridor, nursing his arm as he rounded a corner and disappeared from sight. She was about to give chase again, when the sound of feet came clattering up behind her.
"Jaina."
Her mother was beside her, arms coming around her shoulders.
"Are you all right?"
She nodded.
"Kundertal," she said, waving vaguely in the direction he had taken. "He went that way."
"Don't worry, kid, we'll get him." Her father's silhouette led a mixed group of humans and Quek up the corridor after the former Prime Minister.
"Be careful,"
she yelled after them as her mother's hands guided her down onto the floor, where the world was mercifully level. She crouched there for what felt like forever, fighting nausea. Kundertal had hit her harder than she'd suspected.
"You'll be okay," her mother was saying. "It'll be all right."
Jaina knew that it wasn't. Her thoughts were confused, fragmentary. Something about her fight with Kundertal bothered her. What was it? She had wounded him, she knew that much. She'd cut his arm. Then she saw it, lying in the shadows a few meters away from her. She wriggled from her mother's grasp and made her way over to it, staring at the thing with a mixture of satisfaction and puzzlement.
"What is it?"
her mother asked from behind her.
"His arm," Jaina said, squinting at the limb.
She hadn't just cut his arm. She'd completely severed it below the elbow.
"At least the lower part, anyway."
But there was something distinctly not right about it. Apart from a small smattering and some minor seepage about the stump, there was no blood to be seen anywhere. Sometimes a lightsaber could cauterize veins as it cut and stop the bleeding. It was true. But it wasn't just the blood that piqued her suspicions. It was the smell. It stank of cooked synth flesh.
"It's okay, Jaina," her mother said, coming up beside her. "It's over now. They'll get him, especially if he's injured."
Her mother's words washed over her as she realized uneasily what it was she'd been fighting. Kundertal was a droid.
"No, they won't,"
she said, staring numbly at the artificial arm.
"Even injured, he's going to get away."
Before she could explain, a barrage of fluting sounded from nearby.
"Excuse me, mistress," C-3PO said,
"but Rothen reports that Erinunka has surrendered to the Prek. Fearnry is expected to follow shortly." That should make up for losing Watchkeeper and Intruder, at least, Jaina thought to herself.
"What about Jag?"
she managed to ask her mother.
"Has there been any word?"
"There has," she said, nodding. "He's leading the attack on Fearnry, even as we speak." Her mother's voice was soothing. Under the words, Jaina knew she was trying to say, "It's not your problem, let it go." Maybe she was right. But Jaina doubted she'd be able to relax fully until she knew for sure that Jag was nearby, and they were both a long way from the threat of entechment.